Smith is next.
Listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show. We're taking time off to spend with our families, hoping you the best holiday season possible. We'll see you back here live next year. Happy holidays.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you? Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. Tonight on the big program, we're going to be talking with William B. Gould IV, Stanford law professor and former chairman of the National Labor Relations Board. Going to be here to talk about his piece that was published in the New York Times this past weekend titled Crippling the Right to Organize. You know, we've been talking about it on the program for some time. The Republicans going after workers' rights, going after the Labor Relations Board. Why? Well, to hobble them. Make sure that the laws are still in place, but no way to enforce them. So that the laws against you and I, they're still there. And if they need to enforce them, they're still there. But, you know, on the other side, not so much. We're going to talk with Professor Gould about his piece and his thoughts on the current situation. Also in the first hour, Gar Epurovich, he's going to be here talking about his book, America Beyond Capitalism, Reclaiming Our Wealth, Our Liberty, Our Democracy. You know, he was one of the guys, you know, several years back who said, look, you know, we're heading towards a collapse. It's unsustainable. What we're doing, we're in the death throes of capitalism. Now, I mean, he was one of the few people out there, as I was as well, saying, look, you know, we're going down the wrong path. We're heading for a collapse. And in fact, even I didn't realize it was as bad as it was, because I thought the Bush administration could have at least held it off until they were out of office, making sure that a Democrat who inevitably was going to win would be the one holding the bag when everything fell. That didn't happen, telling me things were even worse than I thought they were. In the second hour, Meteor Blade, senior policy editor over at thedailycoz.org, going to be here talking about his work. You know, the whole beggar thy neighbor thing, the whole screw your worker thing. You know, and it's a good thing that there are all these people out there doing this reporting, telling these stories. As Dave Jamieson, staff writer over at Huffington Post, he's going to be here as well talking about his piece, The New Blue Collar, Temporary Work, Lasting Poverty, and the American Warehouse. Also, your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. So I got this, somebody sent me a quote today that just kind of, you know, the whole idea was a jab at Obama. But, you know, if you really stop and you look at it, this guy, H.L. Mencken, I guess his name is, born in 1880, died in 1956, journal, satirist, comic, whatever you want to call him. He had this quote: as democracy is perfected, the office of the presidency represents more and more closely the inner soul of the people. On some great and glorious day, the plain folk of the land will reach in their heart's desire at last, and the White House will be occupied by a downright moron. And you look at the Bush administration and you go, well, yeah, absolutely. And I thought when Obama came in, the American people said, well, we tried dumb, dumb drunk guy at the bar next to us, didn't work, let's move on. But then what we do, we elected dumb drunk guy at the bar in Congress, which has kind of made everything just stop. I'm really hoping that this next election, we take this seriously. And we look at each candidate based on what they've done, what they've attempted to do, and the vision that they have for this country. And if you look at Congress, Congress is no indication of where we're going. In fact, a new Gallup poll, shows that lowest level in history, 11% approval rating. And I'm going, well, who are the 11%? I'm thinking the top 1%. I get that. And then I guess the next 10% who think they're going to be the top 1%, maybe that's all I can come up with. So there's your 11% that approve of what Congress is doing. That 1% who's doing really wildly well, and the 10% who think eventually when the 1% dies off, they'll move right in. That's all I can think of. As for the whole year, as an average, 17% approval rating. And I flip that around. What's their disapproval rating? 86%. 86% of the people say, you know what? Congress is screwed up. Something needs to be done. And for the first time that I can really remember, you're now seeing the majority of people saying, my guy stinks too. Because most polls you saw were, Congress is horrible and they're doing a horrible job, but my congressman is doing a good job because he's bringing home the bacon. We're seeing that post office being built or that federal building, or we're seeing the money coming in to revitalize our inner cities or redo some things because they were bringing home the bacon, got the earmarks. Well, no earmarks, no money coming in, no seeing that their congressman is actually doing anything. Now 2/3 of the people saying the incumbent's out. Pretty amazing to me. 55% of the people, and this is where there's part of me that has hope. 55% of the people said that they agreed with the statement the political system can work fine. It's the members that are the problem. And 32% of the people said the system's just broken entirely. But 55% said, you know what? It's the people. The system works when you have people who are willing to work together. And it's this polarization that we've seen. And I think, this is where the voters have to make up their mind. You can't have ideologues on each extreme. There are some things that we have to take in common. Social Security, Medicare. We have the right to join and form in collective bargaining and unions. Things that in the past used to be common sense. Used to be things we all agreed on. And there were some things on the fringe that you fought over. But for the most part, as a nation, we were going right down the middle of the road. We were hitting it right down the fairway. And some of the little stuff we bickered over, but for the most part, I go back to the Eisenhower quote. Anybody who would be against labor unions or Social Security or the Farm Bill would never be heard from in the political spectrum, other than a handful of oil billionaires and a couple of businessmen, people on the fringe. Well, those people on the fringe are now in control. What we need to do is take back our elections, take back our political system, get the money out of it. Sorry, corporations, you're not people. And then start looking at priorities. You look at the priorities that Republicans across this country have gone after in state houses and in Washington. It's about abortion. It's about we need to defend that institution of marriage that they don't even believe in honoring. They push division and dissension. They roadblock and they delay just enough to keep us on the brink of collapse, just enough to keep us at the edge, looking over, going, oh, one more step, and it's all over. And that's what this whole thing is over these tax cuts. If this were a tax cut for the millionaires and billionaires, it has sailed through. They'd been on the golf course by now. But since it's for you and me, well, basically screw you. You're getting nothing out of this. So instead of doing what they should have done, Look, I wasn't in favor of a two-month extension. I would have loved to have seen a year. Two-month extension is what you got. That's what the Senate was able to compromise on. Take that, move on, and get in, pick it up next year. Would I have liked to have seen a year? Absolutely. But it's not going to happen. And the Republicans know it's not going to happen, which is why that's their talking point, which is why that's the reason that they're pushing so hard for this. And you go, well, you know, what were they doing while they were supposed to be debating extending the unemployment benefits and the tax cut? What were they talking about? Well, you know what they were talking about? And I, again, one of these things that just kind of makes you go, really? We're going to pass a resolution to put some money to making a bust of William of Churchill? Really? Are we doing that? We're going to commission a bust of Winston Churchill? That's what we're going to do? That was more important than sitting down and arguing and talking about 160 million people getting a tax cut? That the bust was so important? And then, look, this bust thing, really a shot at Obama, if you think about it. Because if you remember, back in 2009, the White House returned a bust of Churchill, sent it back to the British Embassy, as I remember. I think it was 2009. So this was kind of a shot at him as well, saying, well, you didn't get what you want, and look, we're sending you the message. So I find it interesting that they're taking the positions that they are when they know nothing's going to come of it. And look, it's about priorities. You know, I look at this this National Center on Family Homelessness report that just came out. 1.6 million children in this country homeless. One out of every 45 kids homeless last year. These are the kids that are living in shelters. These are the kids that are living in their parents' cars, abandoned buildings, parks, wherever they can find shelter. And yet, what are we doing? Commissioning money to make a bust of Winston Churchill? Really? When we should be talking about how we get money into workers' pockets, how we extend unemployment benefits, and how we help folks. Understand, if that unemployment comp fails and all those people are kicked off of unemployment, that 1.6 million children, that's going to go up. That one out of 45 kids, probably going to be one out of every 40, one out of every 35. Because homelessness, especially among young people, has skyrocketed by 28% since 2007. And that's really thanks to the economic collapse. But what have we done? What have we done to stop this? You look at the numbers, man, and I listen to the Gingriches and I listen to the Republicans. Well, we want to be the paycheck party, not the food stamp party. Well, what are you doing to create jobs? Oh, yeah, nothing. 42%. 42%. Of the kids that are homeless, under 6 years old. A third, and this is the part that grabs me and says, we got problems. A third of the kids live with single mothers who have chronic illnesses. And they're homeless probably because they don't have health care. And now you've got these kids out on the streets with this. What's that say about us? And I go back to, it's how we treat the weakest among us. It's how we treat the elderly. It's how we treat the poor. It's how we treat the children. The right loves, the right just loves the fetus, loves it. As soon as it comes out and becomes a human being, I guess that's the problem. They like conception, they like gestation, they like popping out, you know, they like the whole birth process. As soon as it's out, you're on your own, brother. This is the family values party. Family values. They care. Yeah, they care enough. They care enough to make sure that in a couple of days, you may see more people unemployed. You may see more people kicked off the unemployment rolls, and you will definitely see, if those things happen, more children homeless. I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Professor William B. Gould. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Yes, it is all about the children, even after they're born. Rick Smith. Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham.
Our house! Our house! About 1,000 Wisconsinites on Monday defied new protest permit rules that Republican Scott Walker is trying to impose on Capitol protests. Hundreds of thousands of people turned out in February and March of this year to protest Walker's attack on collective bargaining rights. And for 240 days now, the Solidarity Singers have sung labor, civil rights, and social justice songs in Wisconsin's Capitol Rotunda. They used a people's mic check to boldly assert their free assembly rights in the rotunda and then filled it with song around the Wisconsin Christmas tree.
Wisconsin State Constitution!
Wisconsin State Constitution!
Article 1, Section 4.
Article 1, Section 4.
The right of the people.
The right of the people.
Peaceably to assemble.
Peaceably to assemble.
To consult for the common good.
To consult for the common good.
And to petition the government.
And to petition the government.
Or any department thereof.
Or any department thereof.
Shall never be abridged.
Shall never be abridged.
Fight on.
The National Association of Manufacturers doesn't believe that workers should be informed about their rights on the job. Jesse Russell reports.
On Monday, the organization spoke in court against a new rule by the National Labor Relations Board, which requires employers to inform employees that they have the right to form a union. As a result of the hearing, U.S. District Court Judge Amy Berman Jackson has asked the NLRB to delay enforcement of the new rule. The poster, which began arriving at businesses last week, informs workers about their rights to bargain on contracts. The National Association of Manufacturers claim that the posters will result in 70% of their members becoming less likely to hire and expand. The complaint goes on to allege that posting the poster is a violation of the free speech of employers. The NLRB says they have the right to make such a rule due to the National Labor Relations Act, which charges that employees must know that such rights exist. Businesses are already required to hang notices regarding workers' compensation, polygraph protection, occupational safety and health, and other laws and rules.
This newscast was made possible in part by AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
If the federal government continues to do the kinds of things that this administration is trying to do through the back door, through the National Labor Relations Board, that's killing our free market system.
We're running out of rich people in this country.
The NLRB has become a political sycophant for labor unions.
And one of the things the Congress should do immediately is defund the National Labor Relations Board.
It seems to me that what we're seeing is a ceding of power from Congress to these, to the NLRB and other agencies.
It really is a freedom versus tyranny issue.
I'm a member of the GOP, trying to form a plutocracy, but if I can just bamboozle you,
what a wonderful world it would be if you didn't know your rights. What a wonderful world it would be if you weren't able to stand together and collectively bargain. You know, and again, you look at these attacks. Do you really think that the GOP has the worker in mind when they're talking about defunding the NLRB and neutering it? Not so much. Our next guest wrote an excellent piece this past weekend, Crippling the Right to Organize, was in the New York Times. He's also a Stanford law professor, former chairman of the National Labor Relations Board, and the author of the book Labored Relations, Law, Politics, and the NLRB, a memoir, Professor William B. Gould. Professor Gould, thanks for taking time for me.
Oh, good to be with you.
You know, I look at these attacks that have been going on pretty much all summer by the Republicans wanting to take, when I say taking workers' rights away, to be able to collectively bargain and join unions.
Yes, this is sort of deja vu, as Yogi Berra said, all over again. You know, this is what they were doing to us at the NLRB when I was chairman in the 90s. They didn't have the votes then, nor do they now, to repeal labor law outright. And so they're trying to repeal it through a variety of other means. And they're both, as one of your quotes pointed out, trying to defund the NLRB. They're trying to harass the NLRB in a variety of ways and forms. Of course, they're trying to make second guess and call the NLRB on the carpet for every decision and ruling that it makes. And this is not only inconsistent with the purpose of the labor law, which is designed to promote freedom of association and the right to organize, but also it's inconsistent with the rule of law itself.
And what they've done a masterful job of is they've taken this agency that even most union members, I don't think, really understand what they do or know what they do, and they've really tried to demonize them and make them this evil entity. And so I guess the first question I've got to ask you is, first, what is the role of the NLRB, and what was its original intention, and why was it enacted?
Well, the original intention, and it's in the preamble, unamended, despite all the amendments in the statute, is to promote freedom of association amongst all workers so that they can band together for the purpose of engaging in collective bargaining. The preamble of the statute says that public policy of the United States favors collective bargaining, promotes collective bargaining for workers. And that's what the Republicans can't accept. And what the NLRB is charged with doing is implementing this policy in two ways. One, through the conduct of secret ballot box elections through which a majority of workers are to express their view about whether they wish to be represented or not. And secondly, to implement this policy through unfair labor practice machinery, which protects workers from discrimination on account of union membership, from being singled out or retaliated against for expressing a pro-union point of view, and which also enforces the duty to bargain collectively with the union once it's been selected by a majority of the workers. Now, the law, as I point out in the op-ed piece in the New York Times last Saturday, is imperfect. That in part is what gave rise to proposals that many of your listeners will know about involving the Employee Free Choice Act in
right.
2009 itself. The administrative machinery is cumbersome, and that means delay, and just as delayed is justice denied. And one of the ways that employers have been able to manipulate the statute is to delay elections from being held, to delay the implementation of the rights of workers. But the statute remains an important one because it provides for the reinstatement of workers who are unlawfully dismissed or demoted, the acquisition of the job from which they are demoted from when it's engaged in, because of the workers' involvement in concerted activities, protesting working conditions. It's not only union activity, but the right to band together concertedly for the purpose of protesting working conditions. And then, of course, the award of back pay, which is not enough, which is one of the things that the Employee Free Choice Act would have done. It would have provided for treble or double damages, rather than simply back pay itself minus interim earnings. But
right. If I remember right, back in the late 70s, they were trying to push for a penalty of three times the lost
right.
wage.
That's right. Sometime in the late 70s. That's been going on since, the problems with the statute began to appear in the 70s. The Labor Reform Bill of 1978 passed the House of Representatives, was supported by President Carter, filibustered to death in the Senate, and all attempts to reform the statute since then have run afoul of the Senate filibuster, which plagues so much that President Obama, President Clinton, and now President Carter before them tried to do.
Yeah, I remember, in fact, when President Clinton tried to push through the strike replacement bill, it was Bob Dole, oddly enough, who was the one who filibustered that in the Senate. But we keep hearing this frame, and maybe you can help me with this, because we keep hearing this frame that we need to be more business friendly. We need to deregulate. We need to cut taxes. We need to allow for repatriation, all kinds of things. And if we do these magical things, prosperity will poof. It will all happen. Is there anything in the National Labor Relations Act that gives employers rights? I mean, I keep hearing about these elections since the NLRB has, they want to speed up the election process. I keep hearing we need to give employers the right to talk to their employees. You know, never mind the fact that they've had since day one of employment to talk to them, but somehow they need more time now.
Yeah, well, the Taft-Hartley Amendments in 1947 tacked on a so-called free speech proviso, which was designed to protect employer rights. Actually, the Supreme Court held in the Warren Court said in the late 60s that both as a matter of constitutional and statutory law, employers have the right to free speech. And that's all well and good, and they have that. And although unions don't have access to express the union voice on private property because of the maiden opinion by Justice Thomas in 1992 involving a retail department store where the court held, a divided court held, that union organizers have no access to private property. But what is emerging in connection with this debate about expediting NLRB elections, where the Obama board is trying to expedite them? They haven't gone far enough. They've modified and compromised. But the employers seem to think that there's a primacy to employer free speech. And I ran into this when I was chairman of the labor board in the 90s, where when we called, for instance, for postal ballots, which diminished the opportunity of employers to use last-minute captive audience techniques, beaming their own message to employees 24 hours before the election. They seemed to think that this was the end of the world because they didn't have as effective weapons to communicate their own message to employees. But they have this right. But they seem to think that there's a – and they've come to expect under the Bush board in this century the idea that – they seem to have the idea that this right is one that is primary and overrides other – considerations that are contained in the statute. Remember, I started out by saying that the basic purpose of the statute is to provide freedom of association, the right to organize to employees. There's nothing about employer free speech. Yes, employers have the right to engage in free speech, but that doesn't override the need for quick, effective elections, which will deny employers the ability to delay and to whittle down previously obtained union majorities through speech, sometimes coercive, sometimes non-coercive. There's a world of litigation about that.
Right.
But the idea of what the Obama board is trying to do and what I tried to do in the 90s is to get on with it, to get the votes counted, and then litigate about the question of who's entitled to vote afterwards. And then you work that out. But the votes are cast, and the votes can't be affected in the interim.
Yeah, I loved when they were coming around here to Harrisburg, the Americans for Prosperity people, and they brought a mock voting booth where they wanted people to come in and vote. And I asked to vote, and they wouldn't let me. So it's kind of interesting. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with Professor William B. Gould, Stanford Law professor and former chairman of the National Labor Relations Board. He's also written a good book, Labored Relations, Law, Politics, and the NLRB, a memoir. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Take you right over to the Powell site where you can pick that up. In your piece, you wrote that you thought that the complaint against Boeing was somehow legally flawed. Why is that?
Yeah, I think it's legally flawed. I mean, again, I want to say, as I've said consistently, that the facts would have had to come out at the hearing before the administrative law judge. But as I understand it, the employer was saying to the union and Boeing, and I think machinists dispute some aspects of this, that they wanted a no-strike clause. If they couldn't get a no-strike clause on contracts when they became open, they were going to steer their investment elsewhere. There's nothing wrong with a no-strike clause, obtaining peace for uninterrupted peace for a period of time. I mean, employers have no-strike clauses in collective bargaining agreements altogether.
Right.
And labor law, perhaps excessively in my view, provides that employers have the right to lock out unions and disputes altogether, which is far more severe than what Boeing was alleged to be proposing in this particular instance. The lockout, my goodness, will deprive employees of their income. Nobody at Boeing was losing any income. In fact, at the time of the complaint, guys were getting more income and more jobs. Well, so I think that that was a matter for collective bargaining, not a matter for the labor board, which has its hands full.
Right.
With problems that are crying out, where employers are dismissing workers and organizing drives before they can even get off the ground, and where we need to divert resources to that and not to mature, full-fledged bargaining relationships. And I'm delighted that Boeing and the machinists have resolved their differences, and I think it was a mistake for the acting general counsel, who was on my staff when I was chairman, to have taken this decision.
Yeah, I think we agree on the fact that the system worked. They came to an agreement as they were supposed to. And you're the expert here, far more intelligent than I am, far more well-versed than I could ever be. But here's my problem with it. As I have talked to numerous folks about this, the threat was there. If you don't give us this, we are going to move.
Yeah.
And the question then becomes, do workers in this country have the right to strike without fear of reprisal, or don't they? And I guess the bigger question then becomes, why don't we have uniformity in labor law? I look to Ontario, Canada, for instance. Their language is practically verbatim to ours, yet they don't seem to have the same abuses and problems that we have.
Well, I think the Canadian labor law from a worker perspective is vastly superior to American labor law in a number of respects. One of them is the issue that we're talking about earlier, the way in which they have elections in 5, 10, 15 days after the time a petition is filed, which is not even encompassed by the proposed rule that the Obama board is promoting. From 1937 onward, we've said that an employer proposal to have a no-strike clause in their collective bargaining agreement, which denies the right to strike during the term of the contract, is perfectly lawful. And indeed, it is a mandatory subject to bargaining, which the employer can insist upon. The employer doesn't have to come to an agreement if there's a difference on a matter like this. There's nothing wrong with an employer saying, okay, well, if I can't get my way on this, as a matter of labor law, if I can't get my way on this, I'm going to take my marbles some other place. Although they weren't saying that. You see, this is, again, what I think is a substantial waste of time for the board in dealing with the Boeing. They weren't saying, we're going to take our marbles elsewhere. They were going to say, we're taking this particular production line elsewhere. In fact, the guys there in Washington State were getting more jobs. Now, where I agree with the union and Boeing is that whether the general counsel was right or wrong, and we can only be sure about this once we see what the facts were
right
in a hearing before an administrative law judge. We never had this. But whether he's right or wrong, Congress had no business trying to penalize the general counsel for making a decision that they disagree with. They had a right, as the House of Representatives did, to pass a bill trying to reverse what the acting general counsel did. There was a lot in that bill that was very silly my view, but that's the way to address differences of opinion between Congress and the board. Instead, what Congress tried to do is bludgeon the acting general counsel and scare him try to get him to back down by subpoenaing him. When he went down to South Carolina to testify, he was met by a marshal who escorted him to the proceeding down there before the ISSA committee. This is part and parcel of what the Republican Congress did to us in the 90s and what they are doing in the Boeing case and indeed in so many other matters. But I think the acting general counsel made a mistake by opening the door to unnecessary disputes when there's so much on the table that is vital and important from the statute's perspective.
All right. You also write in your piece, a new vision for labor management cooperation must include not only a more powerful board, but also a less partisan one with members who are independent and neutral experts. Otherwise, the partisan morass will continue and American workers will suffer. In this day and age, is that possible?
Maybe it isn't possible. I don't know, but it's got to be tried. Nobody has tried it. You see, what happened in the 1990s was that President Clinton acceded to the Republican demand. The Republicans went to him and they said, hey, we're not going to confirm Professor Gould until we get our people on the board. And President Clinton said for a number of months, and he sent letters to the Republicans to this effect, oh, no, you've got to confirm Professor Gould, then we can talk about the other people. Now, they stared him down, and so a group of people were all confirmed together when I came on March 2 of 1994. And what has happened ever since then is that you've got the, and you saw this letter that Senator Hatch has sent to President Obama today or yesterday saying, oh, before you make any appointments, you've got to come to us and get our concurrence.
Right. That's
amazing. It's not that they don't make the appointments. It's the advice and consent of the Senate. It's the president who makes the appointments. But what has happened ever since 1994 is this so-called tradition of what Senator Hatch speaks of has grown into a rule. And what has happened is that, labor gets its appointments from labor's ranks. Management gets its appointments. And the management appointments, by the way, under this system, many of them, not only are they completely unsympathetic to the statute, they have no background in labor law whatsoever. That's the case with the Republican who's on the board at this very moment. His only qualifications are being
on the right side of the ideology.
Labor policy, not a labor policy guy, just Senate policy guy. He's the guy who's trying to get the campaigns going to defeat Democratic senators. Those are his qualifications. He's threatening to resign. Now, we've got to get away from this. And the president has to take the lead in appointing people who are independent and not attached to one side or the other. And don't accept these Republicans who are extreme and who are against the statute. President Clinton did it. President Obama is doing it, saying, oh, whoever, Senator Lott, Trent Lott of Mississippi, whoever you want. That's what President Clinton said in 1997, 1998, 2000. Whoever you want. In fact, Lott began to name some of the Democrats as well.
Right.
The president is supposed to name this person, and this should be an independent person. We should get out of this partisan morass. It is leading us nowhere.
I absolutely agree. I got about 30 seconds. Three quick questions. Should the president on January 3rd recess appoint a bunch of people?
Well, I think he should if he can. Now, the House, thus far they've been trying to preclude him from doing so by refusing to go into recess. If he can, he should appoint at least one person to give the Democrats a majority to allow the board to function.
Right.
I don't believe he should put together another package, which has been the death knell for an effective board, and just provides the Republicans with a rear guard to undercut the board from within.
another question, the posters that were that they're talking about making employers putting up, telling workers of their rights to organize. Good idea or bad idea?
Well, it's a good idea. Of course it's a good idea. My goodness.
Overstepping their bounds?
Pardon?
Overstepping their bounds?
It may well be, I have to say, sadly. Unfortunately, you know, all these other statutes, and I talk to my students about this all the time, OSHA, Title VII, all of them, workers' compensation, they all have provisions in them that give the government the right to post these notices. The NLRA has never had such a provision. It should have such a provision. And I think that the absence of a provision giving the board the authority to do this is going to make it a very steep hill to climb. It's a worthy cause, but I'm not confident about the board's ability to prevail on this.
And the last thing, grad students. We're seeing that going around a number of, Chicago, I think Yale, a number of colleges there, their grad assistants are trying to organize. Yes or no?
Well, I think that the board has before it a case which would give them the right to organize and use the statute. They should have it. They are employees within the meaning of the act. The medical interns are also employees. They're students, but they're also employees. And I think just it belies common sense to say otherwise.
Alrighty, Professor William Gould, I appreciate the time. Thank you so much for joining us.
Very good to be with you.
Great talking to you. Professor Gould, Stanford Law Professor, also former chairman of the NLRB. Also his book, Labored Relations, Law, Politics, and the NLRB, a memoir. Link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on the professor's name. Take you right to Powell's books. You can pick it up right there. Quick break, right back after this.
This is a union town, all down the line. This is a union town, all down the line.
United we bargain, divided we beg.
As the wise old adage says, those who live in glass houses ought not throw stones. That's the moral of today's fairy tale. Tracking the truth-impaired governor of Texas as he stumbles madly across the country in the vain hope of being the GOP presidential nominee. Rick's latest fairy tale is in the form of a campaign ad he's running. In it, he scolds members of Congress who leave office to become lobbyists. That's, quote, a form of legal corruption, Perry piously intones. Well, he's right about that. But there's not even an iota of truth in the suggestion that he's the one to fix it. As governor, Perry's been the poster child of revolving door corruption between his own office and corporate lobbyists. For example, guess who is now running the super PAC that's supporting Perry's White House bid? Mike Toomey, who went from being a state legislator to being a highly paid, tassel-toed corporate lobbyist in Texas. Then, Toomey the lobbyist spun back through that revolving door of corruption to become Governor Perry's very own chief of staff. Then, whoop, 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 he spun out again to become an even higher paid lobbyist, using his ties to Perry to get government favors for his corporate clients. Indeed, several of Perry's top staffers have been revolvers, coming to his office directly from the lobbying corps, or leaving the governor's office to go into corporate lobbying, or both. And while he's now pointing his finger of shame at Washington's revolving door, he's hush-hush about the fact that Texas has had more lawmakers turn lobbyists than any other state. Yet, in his 10 years as governor, he never made a peep of protest about their corruption. This is Jim Hightower saying, no matter what Perry's campaign ads say, Rick the Reformer is to governmental ethics what Newt Gingrich is to marital fidelity.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Your working class radio experience. Where hard work, common sense, and rational thought are a reality. The Rick Smith Show.
You want the witness of change, and the time for act. We gotta take the power back.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Question, comment, something on your mind. You can also email me, Rick at therickSmithShow.com. So our boy Tricky Ricky Santorum up to his old tricks. He was picking up an endorsement from the ultra-right-wing homophobic group, The Family Leader. And while he was at their headquarters in Pella, Iowa, he seemed to embrace the idea of inequality. He said, quote, they're talking about income inequality. I'm for income inequality, he said. He said, I think some people should make more than others because some people work harder and have better ideas and take more risks and do all those right wonderful things. He said they should be rewarded for it. He said, I have no problem with income inequality. And again, you know, you look at all the people who are out in the streets. We've been to some of the occupations around the area, and they're saying, you know, this is killing the nation. This consolidation of wealth in the hands of such a few, killing our democracy. And that's why I've asked Gar Alperovitz. He is the author of America Beyond Capitalism, Reclaiming Our Wealth, Our Liberty, and Our Democracy. Gar, thanks for taking time for me.
Good. Thanks to be with you.
You know, I look at the people in the streets, and I look at, you know, Rick Santorum saying, I'm all for inequality. Is this the direction we've gone as a nation? Were we a presidential candidate saying, yeah, I like it just the way it is?
Well, it's amazing. It's 1% of the society with more income than the bottom 60%, highly unequal. It's almost medieval, and I don't mean that rhetorically. That's the way they organize medieval society, and it's certainly not democratic.
Yeah, I just saw something yesterday. So I forget who the group is that came out with it and said that we're more unequal than the Romans were just before their downfall.
I think that's right. I think that's right. We're just beginning to, Wall Street, the Occupy Wall Street people have begun to make us understand that, and it's high time we did.
You know, for a lot of people, and I was one of them, you, obviously back in 2005, raising the red flag of this cannot continue. We're in the cancer stage of capitalism. It's eating itself. Do you find that people are now looking back at what you were saying? Because I know I do, because I've been raising the flag for a while, saying, how did you know? So I guess the question is, how did you know we were heading down this wrong path towards collapse?
Well, you know, it seemed pretty obvious. The trends were of growing inequality were obvious, and also growing the loss of democracy. You know, the Occupy movement picked up on two things. One, the bankers and the wealthy taking extraordinary amounts of money, but also these lobbyists in Washington really destroying our democracy. And those things had to come together at some point. So, you know, in 2005, I suggested at some point that's going to explode. Of course, I didn't know they'd do it as well as the Occupy people did it, but it had to explode. And I think it's forcing people to really think, where are we going, and what is the answer? And I wrote this book, America Beyond Capitalism, trying to point out that there are a lot of answers on the ground that we can build on if we want to.
Now, you know, as a kid, you know, I grew up in Cleveland, spent most of my life in Cleveland, and I look at some of the things that they're doing there, this Cleveland model, this idea of co-op and employee-owned stuff. Is this the direction that you're considering taking us, the Mondragon idea, in that direction?
Well, I think there's a lot on the ground. You know, there's 130 million Americans are members of co-ops or credit unions. There are about 14 million people who are members of worker-owned companies. If you look at the Cleveland model, that's a group of organizations in Cleveland that are worker-owned companies. One's a big industrial-scale laundry. Another one's does solar installations. More installations are online than are in the whole part of Ohio and the whole state. And another is a greenhouse capable of industrial scale, capable of producing, something like 3 million heads of lettuce. These are not little things. These are worker-owned co-ops linked together, and they are put together to try to build a community, not just to make a few workers right. They're linked together in a nonprofit corporation so that it's a community-building effort. That sort of thing is going on all over the country. The Cleveland one is one of the most advanced, and it's, in that case, using some of the hospitals and universities to help purchase from them. But in other parts of the country, you're seeing the same thing. And I think that's where the direction of one part of the direction for the country is, changing who owns wealth in a more democratic form rather than the 1%. These are democratic, and they're very much in the American tradition, and I think we're going to see more of it grow around the country as the pain levels grow. We're seeing it in every part of the country.
You know, what do you say to the Rick Santorums of the world who say that what you're talking about is socialism and it's Marxism and it's not the American way?
Well, it is. I say, Rick, you better check your history. Some of this goes way back to the Grange, the early co-ops. Some of it you find coming out of the labor movement. Some of it you find out coming out of different parts of the agricultural co-op movement. It's very deep in the American grain, and it's very American at heart. The, you know, an America beyond capitalism is going to build on what we have, not bring some foreign idea in. I think we're going to see, for instance, in municipalities, even in the South, in some of the conservative parts of the South, there are a lot of public utilities. 25% of the electricity in the United States is generated by public, you call them socialist utilities. They're all over the country, though. Nobody uses that term because they're very common, very American. Utilities and co-ops produce 25% of the electricity. So I think what's happening, and because the pain levels are growing, and because of the failure of politics in Washington and the shenanigans there and the way the conservatives and the lobbyists have tied it up, I think we're going to see more pain and building of necessity, but building on these very American traditions that change who owns wealth in a very democratic way. I'm quite a, you know, over the long haul, that's a step-by-step process, but it is a powerful process given the trends that are already underway.
Yeah, for me, it goes back to, you know, maybe when people's stomachs get empty enough, their heads will get right, and we'll get away from this massive political divide. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with Gar Alpovitz, his book, America Beyond Capitalism, Reclaiming Our Wealth, Our Liberty, and Our Democracy. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Gar's name. I'll take you right there so you can pick up the book. You know, in looking at the Obama administration, you know, part of me was, you know, in 2008, I voted for the guy, probably the first time in my voting life I voted for a president instead of against somebody else. I thought he was going to be the change. I thought he was going to, you know, he was actually going to change things instead of kind of tinkering around the edges and trying to prop up the old system. How do you see that?
Well, I think he made, you know, a fundamental mistake at the beginning, because when he came into office, he had a huge mandate. He also had, you know, millions of people organized for him and could have helped him. And then he, instead of doing a very large economic program, he did a kind of watered down one with a third of it Republican tax credits that didn't mean much. And then he brought in Wall Street advisors. And I think he really made a fundamental error, because at that moment, he could have been very strong on the economy. He could have moved the progressive agenda and he would have had that huge backing. But he then dismantled all those people that worked for him. It was tragic in some sense, because the opportunity was there with this. Both houses of Congress were Democratic. You know, he's better, certainly better than what we're looking at the other side of the aisle.
Oh, yeah. No question about that.
Yeah, and a lot better than what we see there. But I'm sorry that it makes one, you know, feel really badly about what happened, because I think a lot more could have happened.
Yeah, and part of me takes responsibility for that, because I, like millions of other Americans, you know, worked hard for him to get elected. And then when it happened, you know, my daughter and I went to Washington for the inauguration, and we went home.
Yep.
And when we went home, we said, he's there, he'll take care of it, we're okay. And we turned around, and look what we got.
Yeah, I think that really points to what has to happen now. You know, political change in general, the kind we're talking about, the kind I'm writing about in this America Beyond Capitalism book, it's grassroots change. It's building from the bottom, both politically, but then to take advantage of some of these things that are already on developing a whole different economics. You know, the Bank of North Dakota is a publicly owned state bank, and it's been there for 100 years, and it doesn't speculate on Wall Street. It just helps do local development. Several states, 14 at last count, have got legislation introduced to build public banks to help build what's happening locally. That's another example of this democratic process that the press doesn't cover. It really doesn't have the time or money to do it, and it doesn't have the interest. But just below the surface, you find this everywhere you look. You find interesting new things that are developing, both because there's some new ideas out there, there's some new politics, and there's a lot of pain that says we've got to go in a new direction and build on what's already there. Very interesting things going on that can be done in any part of the country.
Yeah, and why would we want to know about any of those things when we're so interested in American Idol and, you know, the Runaway Bride, and, you know, when we're so interested in those things, the real important stuff.
Yeah, exactly. But I think, just as you said, you know, going home after the inauguration rather than digging down, that was the mistake many of us made, and I think a lot of people are aware of that. I just came back from Wisconsin a couple of weeks ago, and out there, they're really organizing, and they realize that they're going to have to do something both politically,
yep,
but also building these new institutions, and I think that's the direction we're going to see in the future because of the pain levels of everything failing around us.
Yeah, we were out there in February for the height of the occupation when they had the big 150,000 people rallies. We actually broadcast from inside the Capitol. And, you know, it at that moment, you felt the history. You go, this is the beginning of something. And then you see this occupation movement spring up, and you start seeing more and more people coming out in the streets. What do we need to be doing to take advantage of this, to make sure that the steam isn't lost? Can we look to the past, to the people who, you know, maybe of the 60s and the 70s, pushing through some of the things then, to help maybe steer this a little bit? What are your thoughts?
Well, I think that's really the right way to look at it. But it has to have content as well as politics. The demands are one thing. Organizing is one thing. That's the first thing you have to do. But we really need a new content, because one of the problems we face is the labor movement is much, much weaker than it was 30, 40 years ago. So the labor movement is an institution. It's gone from 34% of the labor force down to about 11% and only 6 to 7% in the private sector. We're going to have to build institutions with financial muscle as well as political organizational power.
Right.
And these co-ops on the ground, I think, and the worker-owned companies and the city, state banks and the city banks also, I should mention, that kind of thing begins to build some kind of muscle and displace the big corporations in many areas. That's a long process. My heroes are the civil rights workers, really the ones in the 30s and the 40s who did the hard work laying all that groundwork that was made possible in the 60s. And I think that's where we are now, people who got to be in it for the long haul. And we're talking about transforming or changing the system in a different way, different from corporate capitalism, different from the old state socialism, something very American that draws on our own traditions. But that's a long haul. But I think it's going to take everybody, you know, pulling together and understanding what it takes to make a social movement.
Right, especially when you're talking about these big multinational corporations who don't seem to run out of time or money.
Well, they don't, except now and then when, you know, the auto industry goes down and they run to government to bail them out. And, you know, we nationalized GM and Chrysler in the United States of America. And, of course, when they started making profits, we sold them back and gave them away at the taxpayer. But taking them over is, we did the same thing in the big banks and AIG, except we gave them back to the bankers to make money on. So I don't know what's going to happen in the future on some of these big guys, but we really know where we can start, and that's at the local level. There's a lot of stuff out there. A lot of it's covered in my book, America Beyond Capitalism, but many, many people are doing things. And one of the things that stands in the way is people don't know about it. And the Internet gives us an opportunity to say, hey, I can find out about what other people are doing. And if they can do it in Cleveland, Ohio, which is one of the really devastated cities, you can do it almost any place. So really the question is the ball's in our court to get down to work and start building both a politics and a cooperative. You know, if you don't like the fact that 1% owns 60% of the wealth, then we're going to have to do it in a democratic way. And what does that mean? It's co-ops and worker-owned firms and local banks and state banks and city banks and building up a whole kind of infrastructure of that as a foundation for the new politics that builds a different institutional direction.
Yeah, maybe a progressive income tax like we had under the good socialist president, Dwight David Eisenhower.
Exactly. Let's go back to Eisenhower, 91% marginal rate at the top. I agree with you. That's the other piece of it, tax policy, going after it. But building a different movement is really what it's going to require, and different institutions that change who owns capital.
And I think what has to happen is you have to change who owns media. Because a minute ago, like you said, you know, people aren't hearing about all these things that are going on. And the reason is there's a stranglehold on all media. There are very few progressive outlets. There are very few outlets out there other than the mainstream megaphone for the mega wealthy.
That's absolutely right. But, you know, guys like your program is one that really helps out. And then there's the Internet, which, you know, allows us to circulate information in a way we never could. So that's a technology that at least offers us a kind of a running start if we can get at it.
And fortunately, we can still read and we can buy books like America Beyond Capitalism, Reclaiming Our Wealth, Our Liberty and Our Democracy. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com, a place where you can pick it up. Well worth the read. Gar Alperovitz, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Rick. Appreciate it.
You know, I look at this book, and, you know, again, the book is America Beyond Capitalism, Reclaiming Our Wealth, Our Liberty, Our Democracy, something well worth picking up. Again, link at thericksmithshow.com. We're right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
90% of the people own 90% of the wealth. Where do you fit in? Take a look at yourself. 10% of the people own 90% of the wealth.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to the best of The Rick Smith Show. We're taking time off to spend with our families, hoping you the best holiday season possible. We'll see you back here live next year. Happy holidays.
It's The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. About 1,000 Wisconsinites on Monday defied new protest permit rules that Republican Scott Walker is trying to impose on Capitol protests. Hundreds of thousands of people turned out in February and March of this year to protest Walker's attack on collective bargaining rights. And for 240 days now, the Solidarity Singers have sung labor, civil rights, and social justice songs in Wisconsin's Capitol Rotunda. They used a people's mic check to boldly assert their free assembly rights in the rotunda and then filled it with song around the Wisconsin Christmas tree.
Wisconsin State Constitution!
Wisconsin State Constitution!
Article 1, Section 4!
Article 1, Section 4!
The rights of the people!
The rights of the people!
Peaceably to assemble!
Peaceably to assemble!
Consult for the common good.
To consult for the common good.
And to petition the government.
And to petition the government.
Or any department thereof.
Or any department thereof.
Shall never be abridged.
Shall never be abridged.
Right on.
The National Association of Manufacturers doesn't believe that workers should be informed about their rights on the job. Jesse Russell reports.
On Monday, the organization spoke in court against a new rule by the National Labor Relations Board, which requires employers to inform employees that they have the right to form a union. As a result of the hearing, U.S. District Court Judge Amy Berman Jackson has asked the NLRB to delay enforcement of the new rule. The poster, which began arriving at businesses last week, informs workers about their rights to bargain on contracts. The National Association of Manufacturers claim that the posters will result in 70% of their members becoming less likely to hire and expand. The complaint goes on to allege that posting the poster is a violation of the free speech of employers. The NLRB says they have the right to make such a rule due to the National Labor Relations Act, which charges that employees must know that such rights exist. Businesses are already required to hang notices regarding workers' compensation, polygraph protection, occupational safety and health, and other laws and rules.
This newscast was made possible in part by AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
This is cancer. This isn't a sudden crisis that's going to erupt out of the ground like some monster trying to eat us. This is a slow, wasting process.
I kept the promise till the vow got broke. I had to drink from the laughing cup. I stood on the banks till the river rose up. In the house, in the house, burned, yeah.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. So this past weekend, I saw this story out of Houston, Texas, where the Houston Texans had, they invited this woman to come to a game. Her husband was a Marine killed in Iraq, and they're under the auspices of, they were going to honor her husband, and, they get to take the son to a game, and, kind of the honor and all this stuff. Turns out, the Houston Texans, in conjunction with the people at Operation Finally Home, they're going to give her a house. They're going to actually build her and her son a house, a place where they can live. And that's the kind of nice story I like to hear. Not the kind that we've been hearing recently of a lot of these soldiers who have been coming home finding that they've been foreclosed on or the guy that we talked to, his son came home the day that they all, the entire family got kicked out of their house. Absolutely the wrong direction. But it's good to hear a nice story. Anyway, I've got Meteor Blades on the line. He is a senior policy editor over at thedailycos.org. We got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Meteor, thanks for taking time for me.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
You know, I look at the story of this, you know, this young woman and her child now going to get a house. You know, and I guess it's really a kind of a crummy way to get it, but actually showing some respect for the soldiers coming back, or in this case not, but a much better policy that's been going on.
A much better policy that's been going on. The problem is, of course, you can't really build policy with, you know, one house for one veteran coming back when there are tens of thousands who are going to be back, and many of them are not going to be able to find work. A lot of them, most of them, you know, don't have college degrees, maybe community college a little bit, and they're finding it very tough. The unemployment rate for them, the veterans who are 20 to 24, and actually all the Gulf War II veterans, those people who have been in the military since 2001, their unemployment rate is twice what it is for young people who are not veterans.
Well, what are we doing to help the people that we call our heroes?
Well, there's an initiative that President Obama put forth in August, which does in fact push companies to hire more veterans. Michelle Obama and Jill Biden, the vice president's wife, are working on a program called Joining Forces to encourage companies to do that kind of hiring. There are some tax benefits for hiring vets, those kinds of things. But it's all really piecemeal. And the real problem comes down to, I mean, their situation is not going to get better until the whole economy gets better.
Correct.
And as we know, that's happening slowly, depending on your point of view. It's certainly better than it was 2 years ago when we were still seeing, you know, 500,000 to 600,000 people laid off every month. We're not doing that anymore. But the number of new jobs that are being produced are barely keep up with the number of people who are in the workforce because they get old enough to get jobs. New York Times had an interesting piece about this. I guess it was yesterday, it was the 17th, in which they, you know, talk about that situation, and it's pretty grim for these veterans. And as you say, you know, these guys, I mean, you know, yeah, they're volunteers, but many of them were, in fact, in the military because of the economic situation. I mean, this is nothing new. This has gone on for a very long time in the military, that people have joined because that was the economic opportunity for them. But you know what propaganda is. You know, be all you can be. We'll come in, we'll train you, we'll give you all this, you know, this great advantage. And when you get out, you'll have a much better chance of getting a job. And when these guys get out, they don't have a better chance of getting a job.
Right, because
apparently, the statistics certainly indicate that.
Right. Are you surprised by, you know, because I guess I was kind of surprised by how poorly we treat people that we hold up on a pedestal. I mean, you know, you look at after 9/11, the people who ran into the building, the people who cleaned up the mess, we didn't seem to really want to take care of them, kind of push them to the curb. The folks who were coming back injured throughout the years, maimed, didn't seem to really do a real good job taking care of them. And I look at some of the numbers, the fact that employers aren't saving jobs for, you know, people who are deployed, the fact that they're not hiring veterans, they're not hiring people who are in the National Guard, and banks are kicking people out of their houses while they're serving overseas. Are you surprised by how poorly they've been treated?
No, I'm not surprised at all. I mean, if you take a look at history, this is the way veterans have been treated since at least the Civil War. Politicians love to parade them around on July 4th and, of course, Memorial Day and some other, quote, patriotic, unquote, holidays. You know, they love to have them up on the dais with them when they're speaking, have them in their uniforms with their medals. And after that, many of those politicians, definitely not all of them, but many of those politicians, you know, forget all about those same veterans, you know, who they used for window dressing, you know, when they were making their patriotic speeches. I mean, the Civil War, we had incredible numbers of amputees, obviously other problems for these veterans. And they were, they were basically shunted aside. You know, they were put away in back corners, way whatever, because the society didn't care. You had the same thing happen with the bonus marches after World War One. These were guys who were supposed to get a bonus. I mean, it was small. It was like less than $50.
The pension.
But it was 20 years after World War One, they were supposed to get this $20. Well, in the 30s, they said, look, the economy is a mess. We need this money now. They camped out in Washington. And what was the response? They sent other people in the army, the people who were still in uniform, they sent into, clear these guys out. And it was nasty. A couple people got killed. It was kind of reminiscent of what's happening with the Occupy people, who, of course, those aren't veterans. After World War II, we actually did a good job, a much better job. The GI Bill, which was a Democratic-sponsored bill, which a lot of Republicans, were not happy with, educated people. My stepfather went to school on the GI Bill, got his master's degree. People who went to school who would never have gone to school otherwise, and it created a huge prosperity for a while as a result of this. And we were just as a reference, we were hugely in debt after World War II. I mean, hugely in debt, more than ever before, 120% of GDP, something like that. And yet they took on more debt, so that they could educate these guys. Who had fought overseas. After the Vietnam War, we had the people coming back with, what was then not called PTSD, because it didn't have a name yet, and they said, no, this isn't really a problem, et cetera. And of course, eventually, they came down and admitted it. They denied Agent Orange was a problem, and eventually they admitted it. After the Gulf War, we had the Gulf War syndrome, and we still haven't resolved that problem. Right. There's still denial going on about that, although they finally come around and say, well, yeah, there seems to be some kind of problem here. We had the atomic vets, the guys who were marched really close to, or on boats, ships, very close to atomic blasts. These guys were, ignored. Oh, you don't really have a problem. This isn't related to, being close to a nuclear bomb when it went off. Historically, we have sent the veterans after we have sent them out, you did your duty, and here's a
ribbon.
That's it.
Yeah, I mean, I remember my grandfather, and I've told this story a number of times. When the Marine recruiter came around to my house in the mid '80s, and my grandfather, who served in World War II, and actually knew a couple of people who we did do some testing on in the desert. That they ended up dying a couple years later, just being eaten away by cancer. And he, under no circumstances, wanted any part of me going into the military, and was quite emphatic about it because of that. And, like he said, what GI stands for? Government issue. And
yep.
that means if the choice is between you and a tank, kiss yourself goodbye because you can be replaced.
Well, those tanks could be replaced. The soldiers could be replaced, and they were. I mean, World War II, 13 million people served in the military. Of course, since then, not that many have ever served since. And we have, all kinds of things have happened, I mean, for a soldier in the field, things are a lot better than they, have ever been in terms of intelligence and communication and, all those kinds of things. But it still doesn't stop people from getting killed. Or, in my opinion, worse, so many of these guys, we don't know the numbers, really, come back with traumatic brain injury. And, that's a tough one for everybody concerned. I think the attitude of most people in society has changed. There's an attitude of, yes, we should be doing more for these guys, men and women, but the reality of the policy is still nowhere near where it needs to be.
Now, let me ask you this, Meteor Blades. You brought up the fact that 13 million people served during World War II. Do you think we wouldn't have these problems if more people were involved? Like, had we a draft before we went into Afghanistan and Iraq, and more people's behinds were on the line, so that everybody had a skin in the game? Do you think that we would be treating veterans better? Do you think we may not have gotten into it in the first place? What do you think?
I don't know the answer to that. Obviously, I was a draft protester in the Vietnam War. I went to prison rather than serve. But I know a lot of veterans and veterans coming back from Vietnam I worked with to find jobs. There were homeless veterans, that sort of thing. At that time, like I said, there was the PTSD thing. I don't know. There was a draft then, you know, until, you know, Nixon got rid of it, that those soldiers were treated, you know, all that well because, you know, there had been a draft. Would we have not gotten into that war because of it? I just don't know the answer to that. The problem is that the people who order us to war, rarely have, they certainly never have any draftees in because they can always get out of that. But very few of their sons and now daughters, you know, wind up, you know, fighting in the front line. So as long as the people who are making the decisions about who, you know, who we fight with are there, and as long as they ignore, I mean, remember, before the Iraq War, there were a majority of people who were opposed to that. Now, unfortunately, not a majority in the Congress, but there was a majority of the people, and of course, worldwide, it was even a wider margin of people right. who were opposed, and that didn't stop them. And so I'm not sure that if there'd been a draft, it would have produced enough opposition to stop them then either. It's hard to know.
Now, let me ask you the last question I've got for you. You know, as we move forward, and you brought up the GI Bill, which, I think partially helped create the middle class along with allowing workers the right to organize. What should we be doing to honor these heroes? What should we be doing to give them the opportunity that the previous generation had?
Well, obviously we should stop fighting wars of choice. You know, that's a big start,
yep.
And that produces what I used to call, you know, fewer veterans of future wars. So, you know, we don't have that. In terms of those who have already served, I really think it comes down not so much to, you know, giving them, you know, special programs, although I think, you know, having a good solid GI Bill is always a good idea, whether you're fighting or not. But that's always a good thing to have in the background. But essentially, it comes down to, you know, fixing the economy. And your previous guest, you know, who, you know, I humbled to follow him on your show. But I mean, he talked about some possibilities there. You know, to restructure our economy so that, you know, everybody, including veterans, including non-veterans, you know, has a better chance of being in, you know, in that dwindling middle class. You know, we need to expand that again. I mean, that's the ultimate solution is it comes down to that.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. Meteor Blades, I appreciate the time. Senior policy editor over at dailycos.com. We got a link at our site at thericksmithshow.com to his piece on veterans. Take a look at it there. But thanks again. I appreciate the time.
Okay, good night.
All righty. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. More working people come to talk.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
As the wise old adage says, those who live in glass houses ought not throw stones. That's the moral of today's Perry Tale. Tracking the truth-impaired governor of Texas as he stumbles madly across the country in the vain hope of being the GOP presidential nominee. Rick's latest Perry Tale is in the form of a campaign ad he's running. In it, he scolds members of Congress who leave office to become lobbyists. That's, quote, a form of legal corruption, Perry piously intones. Well, he's right about that. But there's not even an iota of truth in the suggestion that he's the one to fix it. As governor, Perry's been the poster child of revolving door corruption between his own office and corporate lobbyists. For example, guess who is now running the super PAC that's supporting Perry's White House bid? Mike Toomey, who went from being a state legislator to being a highly paid, tassel-toed corporate lobbyist in Texas. Then, Toomey the lobbyist spun back through that revolving door of corruption to become Governor Perry's very own chief of staff. Then, whoop, 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 he spun out again to become an even higher paid lobbyist, using his ties to Perry to get government favors for his corporate clients. Indeed, several of Perry's top staffers have been revolvers, coming to his office directly from the lobbying corps, or leaving the governor's office to go into corporate lobbying, or both. And while he's now pointing his finger of shame at Washington's revolving door, he's hush-hush about the fact that Texas has had more lawmakers turn lobbyists than any other state. Yet, in his 10 years as governor, he never made a peep of protest about their corruption. This is Jim Hightower saying, no matter what Perry's campaign ads say, Rick the Reformer is to governmental ethics what Newt Gingrich is to marital fidelity.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
I will oppose the Columbia Free Trade Agreement.
Now it's time to clear the way for a series of trade agreements.
You can trust me.
From the Nongahela Valley to the Mesabi Iron Range, the coal mines of Appalachia, the story's always the same. 700 tons in the middle of the day, I saw you tell me the world's changed. Once I made you rich enough to forgive my name in Youngstown.
Wow. Every time I hear that, it grabs me. Rich enough to forget my name. I made you rich enough that you could forget my name. And today, and it's kind of ironic that, today, the day Michael Moore came out with his documentary, Roger and Me, December 20th, 1989, where he went around, he followed Roger B. Smith, the chief executive of General Motors, and saying, look what you're doing to our community by deindustrializing the nation. Look what you're doing. Look what it's costing our communities. Look what it's costing our nation. And, you know, the more you look at what's going on across this country, most of our problems come down to just that. It's the deindustrialization. It's the fact that we've allowed jobs to be shipped overseas. And for what? For what? Let's go to the phone line. It's got Andy on line one. How are you doing tonight, Andy?
Hi, Rick. How you doing?
I'm great. What's up?
Yeah, it was a good call with the gentleman from the NLRB.
Yeah, he seems like a good guy. I mean, I don't know that I agree with him so much on Leif Solomon, but, you know, here again, he's the expert. I think he has maybe a little bit more knowledge than I have on it.
Well, he used to head it up. He's just up the road from me, matter of fact. I don't know. I don't catch, you know, all of your programs, but did you ever talk about the article about lead from the old U.S. batteries sent to Mexico raises risks in the New York Times?
I've talked about that in the past. Is there another recent story? I mean, I talked about the lead that we used to put in gasoline and what that's done and a whole bunch of other things with lead. What story are you talking about?
It was on in the December 8th New York Times. It was a front page article.
Yeah, I haven't talked about it in a while.
Well, you've talked about NAFTA quite a bit, and I know you've gone through the numbers of the great trade deficit. And this just hits on that exactly, because in 2007, 6% of our batteries were shipped to Mexico to be recycled.
Right.
This is automobile batteries, right?
Yep.
Now it's 20% of the batteries are sent to Mexico. And that's done because, of course, with NAFTA, you have no environmental protections. They allow like 20 times more the amount of pollution in the air from those battery recycling plants. And as far as the amount of lead, and that's the lead in the air, 20 times more than we would here, and 5 times more in the soil than we would.
What I find amazing, though, by what you're saying there, is I'm amazed that the Mexican government hasn't said, we're allowing this to happen, you should have to, too. Because if you know anything about NAFTA, it's the least restrictive trade barrier. So if their laws are that low, ours have to come down to those standards as well.
Well, of course, what they're trying to do is they're trying to get the at least the authorities there and the doctors who are diagnosing these kids that have lead poisoning, because a lot of these recycling plants are located near schools
right.
and in parts of the cities that have low-income people, and the kids are coming down with, you know, massive amounts of lead poisoning. And, of course, their grades are suffering, and they're doing worse in school because they're poisoned.
They're learning what we learned in the 70s from all the lead gasoline in the 60s and 70s.
Right. And they're saying this year they expect 20 million U.S. batteries to be transported across the border. And, of course, this is the problem that Rahm Emanuel has done. I mean, that all that work, recycling work, that used to be done here, giving jobs to Americans, is just going overseas, you know, over to Mexico, just because they can get away with the lack of environmental standards, they can make a higher margin dollar on it.
That has everything to do with all of our trade policies, not just NAFTA, all
right.
of them.
Right.
And you know, the fact of the matter is we've basically sold out to the highest corporate bidder. Whatever they want, we're doing. And you know, I look at this Cooper Tire thing we talked about last week, where our government, thanks to the steel workers, filed a trade case with the WTO. And put some tariffs on there, which meant that it would be more expensive to produce tires in China. Cooper Tire then had to begin producing here. So what do? They retaliate against their workers by locking them out because they had to bring those jobs back.
Hmm. I mean, just noticed an article in the Financial Times today that some judge had brought up a case that we couldn't put the duties on the tires coming from China. And they also indicated in the same article that the same type of ruling might hold for the solar companies trying to keep the solar panels out, that we're breaching WTO rules.
Well, if that's the case, we better start thinking about what we do with the WTO.
Oh, I know what we can do with the WTO.
We can gather the sheep and get the flock out. Exactly.
Right, exactly.
But at the end of it, when you've got the Germans who are saying, hey, Americans, protect yourself from Chinese dumping. When
right.
a foreign country is telling us to protect ourselves, we got a real problem.
Oh, absolutely. And they're absolutely 100% right. And everybody can see this, but nothing gets done because the multinationals run our Congress.
But Andy, they're good patriotic American companies. They care.
Yeah, they could care less about American workers. You know what it is. The objective is to get us to the lowest common denominator, the race to the bottom as far as workers go.
Wasn't it Thomas Friedman, the great leveling off? Wasn't that his idea, that eventually we'd all be even? We'd raise the Mexican economy up to ours, and we would come down to theirs, and we'd all work for about $5 an hour.
Right, yeah. This is the same guy that said it was great having the boys and girls from the United States go house to house in Iraq just harassing the Iraqis. He thought that was just great, too. Suck on this is what he said. That's Milton and Milton Friedman. That's Thomas Friedman.
Yeah. Uncle Milty's been long gone. But his ideology lives on.
Yeah, Thomas Friedman's taken his place as a stepbrother or something.
Yeah. So what else you got on your mind?
I just wanted to talk about, I thought that battery.
That's an interesting story. I'm going to have to look at that.
Was it? Yeah, it's on the front page of the December 8th issue, and it's a long article, and it just nails it, how the lower environmental standards, that's where the products gravitate to, and it goes to Johnson Controls. It goes to all the battery manufacturers that instead of using their own in-house United States recycling efforts are just diverting all these batteries to Mexico because they make a cheaper margin, and Johnson Controls is the biggest doing it.
Oh,
because they opened up their own recycling plants there, of course, to take advantage of the lower environmental standards.
I mean, it is what we've been doing around the world. It does not surprise me a bit. I'll have to take a look at it. I appreciate the call, Andy. Thanks so much.
All right, Rick. Have a great, happy holidays.
You too. You do as well. Thank you.
Righto. Bye-bye.
There's no surprise there. We know what's been going on. We know what these trade agreements are about. We know, or you should know. It's the least restrictive trade barrier. It's the lowest common denominator. It's the bottom of the barrel. It's not just the race to the bottom. It is the bottom. You know, I tell the story about the Charlie tuna. And most people don't care if dolphins are caught with the tuna. Most people go, But it's the fact that in California they passed a law that said, you know what, you have to have dolphin-safe tuna. If you're going to go out and you're going to fish for tuna, you can't kill the dolphins. They passed a law. It's an idea. You know, you're going to sell it in our area. We're going to regulate how it's done. Well, you know, the Mexican government said that's an unfair That's an unfair trade barrier. You can't have it. WTO ruled on their side. Just like we can't know where the meat is coming from. If there's a big pile of meat coming from Mexico, we can't know where it's coming from. Because we can't mandate nation of origin. Because evidently the Canadians and the Mexicans both sued us and we lost. And I don't know why the Canadians were. I don't really have a problem with the Canadians. It's Mexico. Do they really have any standards? Do we really inspect any of that? The answer is, well, no. But again, I go back to this solar thing that he brought up. The fact that the Germans are saying, hey, you better protect yourself. And we've got politicians who, no, don't worry about it. We believe in free trade, open borders for capital and goods, just not you people. Let's take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
For 75 years, AFSCME has protected basic workers' rights. A living wage, health benefits, safe working conditions. These aren't privileges to be taken away. They're rights to be protected. This is Dave Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13. Public services and workers' rights are under attack like never before. But the Main Street movement is pulling together. Nurses, firefighters, cops, teachers, students, and neighbors. Ordinary Americans are fighting back and making history. From victories in Wisconsin, Ohio, and right here in Pennsylvania, AFSCME was there. AFSCME will always be there. Coming after workers and their unions, it's a shameful agenda for Wall Street politicians, but AFSCME's been in this fight for 75 years. We're not about to stop now. Join the Main Street Movement at AFSCME13.org.
Dear John Bank, I am so sorry it has to be this way, but there's just no choice. I wish circumstances were different, but I can't hide my feelings any longer. I'm in love with another, and you just don't compare. I got tired of you taking advantage of me, charging me higher and higher fees, and raising rates behind my back. I did love you so, but now we have to break up. It's hard, but the right thing for me. I'm with PSECU now, and this credit union treats me right. That's all I ever asked for, to be somewhere I belong.
If you're ready to break up with your bank and take back what's yours, we're ready to help. Call, click, or come in. You can join. Go to PSECU.com/be free and see where you belong.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal Opportunity Lender.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
For everyone who works behind the scenes, you can see them every morning in the factories and the fields, in the city streets and the quiet country towns.
And welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Our quote of the day comes from Robert Reich, former labor secretary. He wrote his piece and offer to the president back on the 14th. He says, the top 1% has an almost unprecedented share of the nation's wealth and income, yet the lowest tax rate in 30 years. Meanwhile, America faces colossal budget deficits that have already meant devastating cuts in education, infrastructure, and safety nets that we depend on. The rich must pay their fair share. Incomes in excess of $1 million should be taxed at 70%, he says, the same rate as before 1981. Well, good luck on that, Robert. We can't even get a 1% increase to pay for the tax extension. Love to see it. Not going to happen. Anyway, but you look across this country and the opportunities that big business sees, they see an opportunity to really kind of stick it to the working people. And all of the shenanigans and all of the games that have been going on, this use of independent contractors, and well, At some point, you got to hope it stops. At some point, you hope that you can get enough political clout to, oh, I don't know, maybe strengthen instead of destroy the Labor Relations Board. Just a thought. That's why I've asked Dave Jamieson, staff writer for Huffington Post, to come talk about his new piece, The New Blue Collar, Temporary Work, Lasting Poverty, and the American Warehouse. Dave, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, Rick, how you doing?
I'm good. You know, I look at this, and, you know, as I read through the story, I'm going, to me, no surprise. You go into these big mega warehouses, and none of those people work for Amazon or you know, these big-name companies. They're all third-party logistics.
Yeah, they are. They're like you said, 3PLs, basically. I went to Joliet, Illinois, in Southern California, the Inland Empire area. They're both really huge logistics areas, monstrous ports these days. And, you know, it depends retailer to retailer, but in a lot of these huge warehouses, there might be 6, 8, 10 different temp agencies operating in there. They're contracted beneath a logistics company, which may be contracted to a retailer up top. You know, in some cases, there are 3 or 4 different companies separating the company at the top of the chain from the workers at the bottom.
And for me, I got to be honest, from the start, I look at that, and that's a company that they're doing that for one specific reason in my mind, is to make sure that their workers never collectively bargain and join a union, never. Because if they make they even rattle the saber that they may, they just fire that logistics company and bring in any number of the other ones willing to take their place.
Yeah, there's you know, a lot of benefits to the subcontracting. You know, the cost savings is a little hard to nail down because, you know, basically, you know, Walmart or whoever is on the top level going to pay a certain premium. And all these corporate middlemen are going to get their cut. You know, but certainly one of the added benefits is this, you know, what some workers feel is a strategic disorganization. You know, you have this huge splintered workforce, where these folks aren't working for a big company. They're all working for different temp companies. And it makes organizing really, really difficult. I know in Joliet, I think this was 2 years ago, at the warehouse for Bissell, vacuum manufacturer, you know, some temps there were organizing, and next thing you knew, the temp company was cut loose.
Well, I mean, on the other side of this, you know, we had talked to one of the Bob Lennox, the Secretary Treasurer for Teamsters Local 495 out in California, the BMW plant that he represents their workers, the parts plant. The company wanted to get rid of all of their unionized employees and bring in one of these third-party logistics companies for about half the wage, as this guy was telling us. Now, the union was able to fight it back, but you do know down the line they're going to try it again.
Yeah, you know, the thing is, you know, in Joliet, there are some union warehouse jobs. And a few months ago, at the warehouse for Central Foods, their big food distributor, they had something like 50 union jobs open up, and over 1,000 people were applying for them. Lots of those people were temps who couldn't believe, you know, the pay and benefits that were going to come with it. I think it was starting at like $16 an hour. You had health benefits, and it kind of blew these temps away that anybody could offer that, because they're used to working for $9 an hour without benefits.
Yeah, and the message then should be, workers, collective bargaining. That's the way to go. And you know, I talked to some people who, you know, there's an Amazon warehouse around here, and they're getting $12 an hour, no benefits or anything like that, but they're doing temp work, $12 an hour, and they think it's great. And I'm going, but you know, back when I was in high school, back when I got out of college, you know, that back 25 years ago, they were paying $12 an hour then.
Yeah, I think it's hard for some people to understand what some of these jobs may have been like 20 years ago, and especially right now when you know, you're just supposed to be grateful to have any job, even if you're getting $9.25 an hour, and you could be out on the street tomorrow if they don't have as much work as they did today. You know, I came across a lot of workers who kind of wanted to feel grateful for what they had, even though, yeah, I think you're right. It is, if you compare it to what it was two decades ago or even a decade ago, these jobs are very different. I think they've definitely deteriorated.
Yeah, and you look at the big story that was here over the summer here in this area with the J-1 visa students who came here into Hershey. Again, most people, didn't know what was going on, or they claim they didn't. But it's this kind of exploitation that our labor law has allowed. And part of me says, this is why we need to get active and engaged and actually start pushing for some comprehensive labor law to take us back to a time where, workers had rights.
Yeah. I mean, the fascinating thing about Hershey and pretty much just like the warehouse stuff, is you've got these were kids from Asia and Eastern Europe, but same deal. They're doing stuff that benefits Hershey, and yet they're, three companies removed from Hershey. And when, they pop up with these, alleging, these abusive conditions, Hershey just, kind of shrugs, and it's like, they just point to the next person down the line. They didn't work for us. Yep. They work for these guys, and these guys say they don't work for us. They work for those guys, and then there's all this finger pointing. And I think that that's one of the big benefits to this subcontracting, especially when you have a huge line of it, like three or four companies, is the big players at the top get indemnified from any messiness at the bottom.
And what's frustrating is, I got to be honest with you, warehouse, I did years of warehouse work. I've got the broken, beaten body to prove it. This is tough work. This is not something you're going to do for 30 or 40 years. You're going to be around a short period of time. It's going to be taxing on your body. It's going to hurt you over the long haul, and you're not going to really be compensated that well for it.
No, I did a little warehouse work too. When I got right out of school, I couldn't find journalism work. I wound up in a mattress warehouse in New Jersey. I did it for, I think it was 5 months, and I still have lower back problems from it. How these folks do it years on end, I don't know. You do it for months, let alone years, you could do damage to your body. And, the problem with temping is, there's no workman's comp for a lot of these folks. They get hurt and then suddenly, you're having productivity problems, and you're out of a job.
And they don't need a reason to fire you, because most states are at-will employment states, so they don't necessarily need a reason. They just say thank you for your service, as long as they don't say anything stupid like, you black kid, get out of here, or you old guy, get out of here, or I'm firing you because you got hurt. There's no reason needed.
Yeah, no, there isn't. Interesting thing on the accountability end, Illinois recently passed a law where it's a temp labor law where if you're going to run a temp company, you got to, tell your folks in writing what they're going to be doing, what they're going to be paid, and how long the assignment is. And one other thing they added is, that contractors at the top have to be accountable to any abuses, carried out by someone they've contracted. Now, I haven't seen, there's been a number of lawsuits in Illinois alleging wage theft and all kinds of shenanigans. None of them have touched any of the big players. There have been a bunch of lawsuits filed against temp companies that are at the bottom of a Walmart subcontracting line. But I think there's hope that among some of the activists out there that at some point they're going to be able to implicate, a big retailer of some kind.
Let me ask you this, and looking at some of the discussions you may have had with people, is there any sense that it's possible to bring people together? Is there any sense that there's the J-1 visa kids, they have a remarkable organizing campaign that went on. Is there any sense that in these warehouses that's possible?
I think so. I talked with folks who were organizing in both Joliet and Southern California, and those are like the two. They're each a major, major nexus for these distribution centers. In Illinois, the UE is making some efforts there, and in Southern California, it's a group called Change to Win, which is backed by UFCW and a few other unions. These efforts have been going on for a couple of years now. I think it's very challenging. It's probably going to be a long struggle if they do get anywhere. just because this goes back to what we were talking about earlier, this huge splintered workforce, all these companies involved in this huge tangle of contracting, and that makes it really, really difficult these days.
Let me ask you this. I mean, at some point, there's got to be a solution to this independent contractor thing because, you know, you see it in construction. You get these people who get these 990s who, you know, they don't pay unemployment. They don't pay workman's comp. They don't pay any of this stuff. And, you know, they're pulling everyone down. And I look at these temp workers, it's not their fault. That's just the situation that they're being stuck in. But legally, what can be done? Is there anything in the works of possibly being done? Anything you've heard?
That's a great question. Interesting. Another industry where this has happened where you would never suspect it is the hotel industry. I did a story a couple months back about Hyatt has in some hotels been sort of quietly outsourcing their housekeeping jobs, where what had been a normal direct hire housekeeper by attrition becomes a temp worker basically through a labor agency. One thing I did see, this was in Cambridge, Massachusetts, just a few weeks ago, enacted a new law basically saying that a hotel that wants to operate in Cambridge, their housekeepers have to be direct hires. The way they got that law through was to basically, they didn't couch it as a labor rights issue, it was couched as a security issue, that folks who are staying in a hotel have a right to know that the people who are coming in their room work for the hotel.
And they're responsible.
Basically, with that on the books, you know, if you're hired or whoever, you're going to have direct hires if you're going to want to have your hotel in Cambridge. So there are some things like that. I haven't seen much, but that's one example. So I think, you know, in certain very progressive areas, you might see some stuff like that.
So you see this maybe something that could happen on the local level as opposed to something possibly federally?
Yeah, federally. I don't know when.
That's kind of a dumb question, wasn't it?
But yeah, locally, you know, certain things can be done.
Because I can wish and hope, can't I? At some point, you got to hope the American people wake up and start realizing that they're consumers second and workers first.
Hmm.
I mean, because I think for too long we've been sold the bill of goods that we're consumers. First and foremost, we're consumers of everything, and we're always looking.
That's this warehouse business. You talk to companies about why they do this, why they're going to have all these workers who aren't directly employed by them handling all their goods, and they do it because they want to have the lowest prices possible for their consumers. Knowing that a lot of this work is basically kind of hidden. It's all, you know, it's behind the scenes.
And you're talking with people. Who would you say is the worst offender in all of this?
Worst offender, I don't want to say there's a worst offender.
All of them.
I will say that one company that I wrote a lot about and which had has had a number of lawsuits on this front is Walmart. A couple folks feel that they kind of, that they've shown sort of the cost effectiveness of having having your logistics contracted out. And some folks feel that other retailers, are following Walmart's lead like they do in a lot of other ways.
Yeah, as the story goes, that's how Sam Walton started the business, cheating his workers out of wages. So no surprise there, I guess. Dave Jamison, I appreciate the time. Again, the article, The New Blue Collar, Temporary Work, Lasting Poverty, and the American Warehouse. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Dave Jamison's name. It'll take you right there. Dave, thanks so much.
Rick, thanks a lot.
Anytime. Quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
To the Rick Smith Show.
Hello, I'm Dave Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME, Council 13. For 75 years, AFSCME has protected basic workers' rights. But Wall Street politicians are coming after workers and their unions like never before.
AFSCME's Main Street movement is pulling together. Ordinary Americans are fighting back and making history. From victories in Wisconsin, Ohio, and right here in Pennsylvania, AFSCME was there. AFSCME will always be there. Join the Main Street movement at AFSCME13.org.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children. AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
My name is Michelle Bachman. I stand here in the midst of many friends and many family members to announce formally my candidacy for President of the United States.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at TheRickSmithShow.com.
Oh, yeah, baby.
Oh, yeah, baby. Just stay away from that EPA.
There's no other agency like the EPA. It should really be renamed the Job-Killing Organization of America.
Yeah, we don't need any of that regulation. Nope, nope, nope. Oh, the crazy one. You got to love Michelle Bachman, though. And again, like I said, when we go up to New Hampshire for the primaries, I'm really hoping that we get a little time with her. And I got to get a picture with her. Just have to do that. But anyway, she's, again, out on the stump. In fact, said something again today, kind of makes you go, really, Michelle? Are you really? That came out of your mouth? Are you a Rick Perry? Just open your mouth and stuff falls out? She said, I'm not a politician. I'm a real person. I don't even know how to be a politician. Oh, my God. I'm a real person. It reminds me of Geppetto in Pinocchio. I'm a real boy. She's a real person. Oh, please. Will someone just stick a fork in her campaign already? Because she's not even worth the comic value anymore. Not even worth it. Anyway, the war on Christmas continues. That's right. The 63-foot Sierra white fir tree that the Obama people put up there on U.S. Capitol grounds back on December 6th. The Capitol Christmas tree. Well, you know what? According to the insaniacs over at CNS News, the right-wing babble that goes on there, do you know that there's an ornament on that tree that says, I love President Obama? Can you believe that? And there's not one that says anything about Jesus, except a couple that, you know, had quotes, you know, and other things. But you know, never mind that. There's nothing on there that says, I love Jesus. And you go, you know, are you really this insane? And the answer is yes. The answer is the radical right that insane. And that in your face about it. And, you know, they're now I'm being pitched every day now for people to talk about the fact that our senators and congressmen, when they send out cards or whatever, it can't be of a religious nature. And people are all enraged by this. And I'm going, well, if you want to send out a Merry Christmas card or a Happy Hanukkah card or a Happy Kwanzaa or whatever it is you send out, you should do it with your own money. I shouldn't, as a taxpayer, have to pay for your well wishes. You send out your communication, tell me what you're doing, But sorry, not so much into me paying for your Christmas card list. Sorry, just not going there. But the radical right, man, they think this is the issue. See, Obama's got a war on Christmas. Even though that policy's been in place for years, it's just that Obama's there now. See, it's that black guy in the White House. That Muslim. Kenyan. Nuts. And what I find amazing is at this time of the year, we're all so Christian to each other. We all treat each other with such love and devotion. And I looked at this story in New Jersey. 20-year-old kid and his 17-year-old friend, they got their video camera and they're going to go make themselves a video. So this kid goes and beats up a homeless guy. And probably one of the most docile homeless people when I watched the video that you've seen. They go and the guy said, well, we're going to go beat up a bum. And we're going to take his bike and all kind of weird stuff. And I'm going, I look at this and I think of my mother. I wasn't afraid of the police. I wasn't afraid of anything other than my mother. And I look at this kid and I go, you know, you watch this video and it is absolutely disgusting. And oh, by the way, he did wish the guy a Merry Christmas. So for all of you insaniacs who think the war on Christmas is taken out of front, he did wish the poor man that he beat up a very Merry Christmas. But for me, that was my kid. I would beat the ever-loving tar out of him. He wouldn't have to worry about going to jail. And fortunately, being 20 years old, he's going to go to jail. He was being held on $60,000 bond, charged with conspiracy. The teen was charged with conspiracy and released to his parents. The 20-year-old aggravated assault. So good for him. Good for him. I hope there's some people who treat him with such kindness. Such kindness. Show him some love and affection. I so wish that for him this holiday season. Anyway, if you've noticed what's going on in D.C., you gotta wonder if the Republicans like Christmas at all. Understand what they're doing to millions of families across this country by not extending the payroll tax holiday and not extending unemployment benefits. Now, look, am I fond of a 2% tax cut? I'd like to see more. I wish that, you know, you could do all of it. That's not going to happen. And I got an email earlier in the show of, you know, someone saying, well, we're going to deplete our Social Security trust fund. No. The argument over this is how do you put that money into the trust fund? Early on, I did believe that as well. I believed that, you know, when we took that 2%, it wasn't going into the fund because we were just giving it away, giving it back to people. No. What's happening is they're offsetting it from somewhere else, and they're actually filling the money in the fund. And they're actually making sure that every dime that's supposed to be there is there, which is why this whole argument over the millionaires paying that increased tax, which for me, what I'd be saying is, look, sorry, we're taking it. We're putting it in. But what you've got is you've got these Republicans who, man, they really must hate the holiday season because they are doing everything they can do to ruin it for a good number of folks. You know, the very people who tell you that they're good, God-fearing Christians. Which an interesting study came out yesterday, I believe it was, that shows the number of Christians worldwide, somewhere around 2.18 billion people, about 31.7% of the globe, about a third, if you will. Now, we're somewhere near 7 trillion people, 6.97, somewhere in that area. So, you know, over the whole, you know, Christians got a good foundation. What I find interesting about the study that they did is, you know, they're saying since 1910, two-thirds of the Christians were in Europe and very concentrated in a couple of areas. Now they're saying nearly two-thirds, not 34% are found in North and South America, 26% in Europe, 23.6% in Sub-Saharan Africa, 13% in Asia Pacific, 6% in the Middle East. And, you know, so kind of going global. And, you know, if you're Muslim, do you look at that and go, they're trying to take over the world? Just a thought. Just a thought. For all those people who think, well, they're after us because they just hate us. No, they probably hate you because you keep moving into their backyard. And that's one of those things that always bothered me about seeing people go over and do their mission work. And I'm all in favor of people doing mission work, helping build new communities and making sure people have food to eat. It's that thumping over the head with the book before you feed them that's always bothered me. Just one of those things. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll take your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Right back.
To America. Rick Smith.
You're listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show. We're taking time off to spend with our families, hoping you the best holiday season possible. We'll see you back here live next year. Happy holidays.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. About 1,000 Wisconsinites on Monday defied new protest permit rules that Republican Scott Walker is trying to impose on Capitol protests. Hundreds of thousands of people turned out in February and March of this year to protest Walker's attack on collective bargaining rights. And for 240 days now, the Solidarity Singers have sung labor, civil rights, and social justice songs in Wisconsin's Capitol Rotunda. They used a people's mic check to boldly assert their free assembly rights in the rotunda and then filled it with song around the Wisconsin Christmas tree.
Wisconsin State Constitution!
Wisconsin State Constitution!
Article 1, Section 4!
Article 1, Section 4!
The rights of the people!
The rights of the people!
Peaceably to assemble!
Peaceably to assemble!
To consult for the common good.
To consult for the common good.
And to petition the government.
And to petition the government.
Or any department thereof.
Or any department thereof.
Shall never be abridged.
Shall never be abridged.
Right on.
The National Association of Manufacturers doesn't believe that workers should be informed about their rights on the job. Jesse Russell reports.
On Monday, the organization spoke in court against a new rule by the National Labor Relations Board, which requires employers to inform employees that they have the right to form a union. As a result of the hearing, U.S. District Court Judge Amy Berman Jackson has asked the NLRB to delay enforcement of the new rule. The poster, which began arriving at businesses last week, informs workers about their rights to bargain on contracts. The National Association of Manufacturers claim that the posters will result in 70% of their members becoming less likely to hire and expand. The complaint goes on to allege that posting the poster is a violation of the free speech of employers. The NLRB says they have the right to make such a rule due to the National Labor Relations Act, which charges that employees must know that such rights exist. Businesses are already required to hang notices regarding workers' compensation, polygraph protection, occupational safety and health, and other laws and rules.
This newscast was made possible in part by AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit Labor Radio.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
I'm still in love with you.
to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can download the podcast there at the big website. Also, if you've got a smartphone, download the Stitcher app and take your class war on the go. Question, comment, something on your mind, Rick at thericksmithshow.com, or you can give me a call here, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. So a new federal government survey out. They're saying that nearly one in three Americans will already have been arrested by age 23. That's up considerably from 1965, when only 22% of the people were arrested by the age of 23. And a lot of it has to do with, look, we have really cracked down on minor drug offenses. We have done an amazing job of cracking down on kind of petty crimes. Now, the big ones as well. I mean, there are people who, you know, they belong in jail, but a lot of the stuff you kind of got to wonder about. And for me, at the end of the day, it comes down to the position that we've privatized our prison systems. And people, investors, big money folks have sunk a bunch of money into building these big prisons. And the only way you make your money back is if you've got bodies in the beds. So you need to push for minimum sentencing requirements. You need to push for three strikes and you're out. You need to push for tougher and tougher laws. And I look here in Pennsylvania. They just changed what the theft requirements, the threshold of a felony when you're talking about theft, from 3,000 down to 1,000. So, again, you know, how much lobbying do you think went into that to make sure that that threshold was lowered to make that felony now maybe possibly mandatory couple of days in jail? And then maybe a second offense, much more stiff penalty. Again, you know, the for-profit industry, they've got the time, the energy, the lobbying money to do these kind of things. And for me, instead of just spending all of our time and energy incarcerating people, we need to figure out how to educate them. How much does it cost to, think about it, how much does it cost to incarcerate somebody for a year? I've seen reports anywhere from $30,000 to $50,000 a year. For $30,000 to $50,000 a year, we could educate someone pretty well. We could actually give them, we could just give them $30,000 a year and say, go be productive, go do something, go spend money, help the economy. Instead of building prisons where you've now got all these people locked up together and all it is they do is they get worse. There's no rehabilitation that goes on. It's retribution, pure and simple. But, you know, kind of surprising. Two-thirds. Or a third of kids are going to be arrested before they're 23. Did you see 60 Minutes on Sunday? Kind of an interesting story about my hometown of Cleveland. I guess they're tearing down a bunch of houses because, look, the folks were foreclosed on. They left the house. The mortgage company refused to upkeep it. In came the raiders. In came the other people, and they ripped everything out of it. They gutted the places. Took all the copper, took all the wiring, took all the siding. The one house they showed, they even took the kitchen sink. Took everything out. The furnaces, light fixtures, everything. So now they're tearing these big, beautiful homes that were at one point were very nice houses, very solidly working class, middle class houses. They're tearing them down, saying that we're just going to make green space out of it. Hopefully we'll rise the property value of everybody else in the neighborhood. Because as they pointed out, you go down on any of these streets and you see several houses for sale, everybody's property value falls. And that's where the real estate agents are starting to play games by only putting up signs on certain days and doing all kind of stuff. And I go back to what I said when the collapse happened. Now, they're the Pat Toomeys of the world, the Mitt Romneys of the world who believe we should have had a harder down.
As to what to do for the housing industry specifically, and are there things that you can do to encourage housing? One is don't try and stop the foreclosure process. Let it run its course and hit the bottom, allow investors to buy homes, put renters in them, fix the homes up, and let it turn around and come back up. The Obama administration has slow-walked the foreclosure processes that have been long existed, and as a result, we still have a foreclosure overhang.
So his ideas, much like Toomey's, Toomey said the exact same thing. We needed a harder down. And he said we needed to bottom out so that investors can come in, buy these houses up, and rent them back to the people who originally wanted to own them. It was their dream to own that house. And now they're going to rent it back from somebody, from the investor class, from people like him. And I said from the very beginning, and I'm as right now as I was then, it doesn't take a genius. This is common sense. And it infuriates me that Obama decided to take the corporate way, decided to go the Wall Street way, and not make people at the bottom whole. What should have happened is exactly what I said back when this whole fiasco began. The federal government sets up a quasi-private corporation that buys those mortgages for current market value, which at the time had depreciated considerably. So the banks were going to take a haircut. They were going to take a good-sized chunk. They were going to lose the equity in it. The people who were in the houses would then owe the federal government that mortgage. They would turn it into a 30-year mortgage at current rates, at current value. You have now stopped the foreclosure problem. And you have a federal program that helps people stay in their homes. Because as soon as you walk away from those houses, because what's going on is people are so far underwater. The $100,000 home they bought is now worth $50,000, and they're going, I can't afford it. I'm walking away from it. Then they mail the keys in, and nobody in the mortgage industry wants to take care of those houses. They just let them go to pot. And the neighborhood comes down with it. And you go, well, why should I care about my neighbor losing his house? Well, you should care because as his house deteriorates, the blight causes your property values to fall as well. And as the neighborhoods deteriorate, it causes everyone's, and it's a spiraling down. Now, Obama's idea was, you know, get the banks to do some modifications and, you know, to try and do some of that stuff, make sure that people had opportunity to refinance. Well, the banks, they want no part of it. Because understand, most of the banks are completely covered. And this is one of those conversations I was having with somebody recently. Why would the banks care? Why do the banks care if there's someone in that house or not? They've got something called PMI. Most middle-class and lower-middle-class buyers didn't have the required 20% to put down, so they had to purchase private mortgage insurance. And guess what that private mortgage insurance does? Well, in the event you default on it, it pays off, so they don't care. You know, I had someone say to me, well, what they should have done is the bank should have sold it, you know, for something. At least they'd get some money out of it. And I go, no. Then the PMI doesn't pay out as much. They're covered. Just like the derivatives, the big investors, the wealth class, they're covered, man. They're always covered. It's you and me who get screwed, which is why when I said what we need to do is make the people at the bottom whole, people like you and me. That idea was taken up by almost no one. Because that's not how we think in this country. We think about protecting socialism for the wealth class, you know, free market, laissez-faire capitalism for the rest of us. We keep us at each other's throats. But we should have done that. We'd be in a much better position. So now what you're seeing is you're seeing some 9 million homes who are empty. And you're seeing, the people come in, taking out the furnaces and all of the copper and all the wiring and all the fixtures, basically gutting the house, making it worthless. So now the only option is now you tear it down. So what I would say is, you know, there's still a chance in doing this right. There's still a chance. But we don't have the political will because we don't have. What you have in this country is a messaging machine that says tough love. You have a messaging machine in this country that says let it bottom out. The messaging machine says they were irresponsible. The messaging machine says, well, they took on more than they could chew. Not that the economy collapsed and they lost hours, they lost their jobs, or lost income. No, it had nothing to do with that. And that it could have happened to any one of us at any time. No, not that. It was those people were irresponsible. And they need to lose that. And they need to go bankrupt and they need to start over. instead of saying, and remember, these are the family values people. Kick people out of their homes, make the families leave the homes that they've been in for 10 or 20 years. Kick them to the curb. Who cares where they end up? You know, that 1 in 45 children who are homeless, never mind them, don't worry about it. They'll find something. But for me, I go, you know, and I guess that's the difference between my program and a lot of the right-wing shows. I'm a working-class guy. I've been at the bottom of the economic scale. I've been in situations when I was a kid where we were evicted from places because we had nowhere to go. I guess maybe those memories stick with you. And as I've said, I could easily be the quintessential right-winger. I pulled myself up by the bootstraps, clawed my way out of the proverbial ooze with my own two hands. Not reality, but it makes for a nice story, doesn't it? And you look at this foreclosure crisis. We could have made the people at the bottom whole and probably a lot cheaper than we've already spent on it. But that's not our mentality. Our mentality is we need to keep those bankers happy. Sad, sad day. Quick break, right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Right back. We want the world and we want it now.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
As the wise old adage says, those who live in glass houses ought not throw stones. That's the moral of today's fairy tale. Tracking the truth-impaired governor of Texas as he stumbles madly across the country in the vain hope of being the GOP presidential nominee. Rick's latest fairy tale is in the form of a campaign ad he's running. In it, he scolds members of Congress who leave office to become lobbyists. That's, quote, a form of legal corruption, Perry piously intones. Well, he's right about that. But there's not even an iota of truth in the suggestion that he's the one to fix it. As governor, Perry's been the poster child of revolving door corruption between his own office and corporate lobbyists. For example, guess who is now running the super PAC that's supporting Perry's White House bid? Mike Toomey, who went from being a state legislator to being a highly paid, tassel-toed corporate lobbyist in Texas. Then, Toomey the lobbyist spun back through that revolving door of corruption to become Governor Perry's very own chief of staff. Then, whoop, whoop, whoop. He spun out again to become an even higher paid lobbyist, using his ties to Perry to get government favors for his corporate clients. Indeed, several of Perry's top staffers had been revolvers, coming to his office directly from the lobbying corps, or leaving the governor's office to go into corporate lobbying, or both. And while he's now pointing his finger of shame at Washington's revolving door, he's hush-hush about the fact that Texas has had more lawmakers turn lobbyists than any other state. Yet, in his 10 years as governor, he never made a peep of protest about their corruption. This is Jim Hightower saying, no matter what Perry's campaign ads say, Rick the Reformer is to governmental ethics what Newt Gingrich is to marital fidelity.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Exposing GOP half-truths, lies, and hypocrisy every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Rick Smith.
Everything's raisin but the weight is. Everything's raisin but the weight is. Just like groceries and our faces.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Question, comment, something on your mind, Rick at therickSmithShow.com. Probably the best way to get a hold of me. Also, you can call me here, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. So as you're looking at the media, how things are going, playing out, especially around the occupations, around the Occupy Wall Street and Occupy wherever, what you're seeing is the really masterful manipulation of trying to divide people. Don't worry about the numbers. You know, like I said earlier, 1 in 45 kids homeless last year. Don't worry about almost half of the nation living at or near the poverty line. Don't worry about that. That's, you know, that's just, you know, that's stuff you don't need to think about. Don't worry about that. American Idol will be on soon. Survivor will be on soon. Don't worry about that. Don't worry about the fact that, you know, one in six people that need food stamps, because we have a massive food insecurity problem. I love that. We have a massive insecurity problem. Not that people are hungry. No, no. We're insecure about food. So don't worry about hunger. It's food insecurity. And don't worry about the one in four children who are eating thanks to those food stamp programs. Don't think about that. Think about those evil, nasty Democrats. Think about that Obama. Think about those Democrats they want class war. Talking about class war, because you know, you know, there's no such thing at the top. You know, the whining at the top, the 1%, is pretty amazing to me. I look at one of the two guys who are the co-founders of Home Depot, calling the occupation protesters imbeciles. Or the other one, the guy I love, saying that he's a fat cat. He said, yeah, I'm a fat cat. Not ashamed of it. If you mean fat cat that I succeeded, yeah, I'm a fat cat. I stand guilty of being a fat cat. And there's pride that they've manipulated their way to being at the top of the heap. And look, there's nothing wrong with being at the top of the heap. But in a rational civil society, you say at some point, the culmination of wealth, the accumulation of massive wealth in the hands of so few, not a good thing for democracy as a whole. Not a good thing on how you would run a nation. Because understand, as they control more and more wealth, and you know, I had this guy one time, he was trying to explain to me that wealth is infinite. And that, you know, the pie can expand and grow as big as it wants. And I say, yeah, the pie can grow and expand as big as it wants, but if my sliver of it is minuscule, and your sliver of it is minuscule, but the guy across the table has 3/4 of it, you still have a problem as a nation. You're going to have a demand problem, which is what we've got right now, is a massive demand problem. Not just here, but across the globe. People are broke. Now, the investor class sitting pretty. I mean, the wealth class, the plush class, the pampered class, they're pretty well. They're doing wonderfully well, thank you very much. They're paying less taxes than they've paid in since the Depression anyway. And since 1995, if you look at 1995, which I remember was not a bad year, the top 400 wage earners, our heavy 400, our superstars, our Forbes 400, the richest of the rich, they paid almost 30% of their taxes, almost a 30% tax rate in 1995. It's down to just about 16.5% today. So as you see that shift in wealth, because understand, that additional 13.5%, that now is in the hands of the top 1%, used to go to fund social programs, used to go to fund education, used to fund paying our debt off. Because let me remind you, when the little shrub took office, Greenspan was so worried he didn't know what the future looked like. They had no models. Don't know what it's going to look like. We don't know what it's like to be debt-free. The models won't work. We don't know what to do. And immediately, Shrub came in and did a marvelous job of ensuring that we never have to worry about being debt-free. Made sure that the top 1% got their massive handouts. You and I, we got our lotto winnings. You know, we got a little something. In fact, you know, we ran out to our mailbox to get our Bush prize. Didn't do much for the economy. Didn't create jobs. Even though, you know, he was saying all the time, great jobs. We're going to create half a million jobs. We're going to create all these jobs. Did it happen? No, didn't happen at all. But, you know, the doesn't stop the frame from continuing. And that's the one thing I love about the right wing. They never let a good frame go to waste. As long as they can continue to push their frame, you can never let that go to waste, man. Too good to be true. And especially when it comes to the tax thing. well, we could cut taxes and create jobs, even though it's never happened, at least not in the way that they say it happens. Now, I say if you give tax breaks to people who work for a living, people who spend every dime, yeah, you're going to create some jobs because you're going to put more money into people's pockets who have a demand. And that's something we seem to kind of forget a little bit. If I give the billionaire class a boatload of money, does it mean that they're going to know what to do with the money to make sure that it's being used the best? No. What they're going to do is figure out how to use that money to make more money. And the more money that they make, well, the more that they put in their pockets. Not necessarily good for an economy. So, I mean, you know, there are a couple of different ideas here. And, you know, you've got to really ask the question is what's best for the economy? Not necessarily best for the investor class. And I look at this article in USA Today the other day. And, again, the idea is to divide and conquer. The idea is to separate generations. The idea is to separate white from black, working class, blue collar, white collar, union, non-union. The idea is to slice and dice us. And they do that masterfully by creating these little fires that have to be put out. So I read this article. The title of it in Useless Today was Occupy Protests Trigger Envy, Ire in Generation X. Because evidently we're angry that we didn't do anything. Evidently, the Generation X people angry that they didn't do anything. And never mind the apartheid thing, which I guess was kind of the big thing of the 80s, you know, the South Africa thing. And there was some protest around that. But, you know, the article's going into saying, you know, the people in the Generation X generation, well, they've missed the boat. They were the slacker generation, and, you know, they didn't accomplish anything. So they're angry. Not just at themselves, but at their peers. And they see these young people, and they're angry at them. Because evidently, according to the article, and I remember the Bush recession of 92. I do. 91, 92, because I was laid off pretty much structurally at that point. It wasn't until Clinton came into office that I ended up getting a job. But and as I'm sure most of you will remember, those were tough years back then. But they're saying, you know, hey, you know, I toughed my way through. These millennials, they should get over it. And as I sit back and I read this article, and it's amazing propaganda. It's beautiful, well written, very, very eloquent on why, you know, we should be splitting apart, and throws people in there who are, yeah, they're not doing anything. They're just, you know, whatever. And I go, I remember that time. You didn't have NAFTA. You didn't have a lot of the trade agreements. There was some talk of it, but it hadn't happened yet. We still had manufacturing. All we had then was a demand problem. And when you kick a little money into it, you get people back to work, it helps. What we're looking at right now is really unknown territory. This generation and my children growing up, they're not going to know what it's like to be the world's largest value-added manufacturer. We've lost that title. The Chinese are the value-added manufacturing champions. We've lost that to them. And I shouldn't even say we lost it. We basically handed it over to them. We said, you know, it's cheaper to manufacture over there. We get better deals, better subsidies. We can exploit labor. We can exploit the environment. And we can screw those union workers back in the old country. And we can still bring our stuff back and claim to be an American company, patriotic. We love our nation. But we can make more money. And I find it quite amazing that we as consumers, after all, don't turn on that mentality. Understand, other nations do. I'm still waiting to see what happens in South Korea, because we had some kind of an agreement with the South Koreans to trade automobiles. Granted, it was really a bad agreement. They could dump, I think, 750,000 automobiles into the U.S., and we could take 18,000 automobiles into South Korea. I really would love to have their negotiator, because he must have been fantastic. Because our guy sucked. I mean, you're talking about 750,000 in, 18 out. I'm not quite sure how that balances, but that was the ratio. And as soon as the the American cars started to sell. Some of our pickup trucks started to sell over there. Well, they passed a law saying that you can't cover the bed of the truck. And that kind of sent the message, and it stopped. Because the people understand, if we don't buy our goods, we don't have jobs. And I think there's part of me that thinks we used to know that, part of me. But the bigger part of me says we need to have the conversation of what is it that our economy is going to be like in the future? And is Gar Apowitz right? Do we need to start, you know, worker cooperatives? Do we need to start local community businesses? Is that the direction? Part of me says yes. But the bigger part of me says we need to rein in our trade policies. We need to rein in our tax policy. We need to make sure that we have policies that encourage full employment. We need to have policies that encourage decent living wages, which means we don't continue this race to the bottom, the Walmartization of this nation. And we need a comprehensive change in labor law. But good luck getting that through the dim-witted, puddle-brained flag monkeys who listen to right-wing radio. Because there are people in this country, the NLRB was the worst thing ever created. Really? Giving workers the right to have a say in the place where they spend a third of it? That's a bad idea? And what's happened over the last 30, 40 years is corporations have done a masterful job of telling you that we're the benevolent corporation. We give you these things. We give you a decent wage. We give you health care. We give you pensions. When in reality, the reason they did that is they were afraid that you would demand them. And I'm hoping that this generation, and I'm reaching out to our millennials, saying you're going to be the ones that have to save us. You're going to have to be that beginning generation that makes my children's generation the greatest generation, the ones who fight and turn this country around for their children. It's got to happen. Because the last generation, well, for the most part, they're looking to the end. They're looking towards retirement. I got mine. The heck with you. Which is why the Republicans are doing everything they can possibly do to say, don't worry about Social Security and Medicare. You seniors, you'll be fine. You baby boomers, you'll be fine. Just screw those other people. Again, more divide and conquer. Let's take a quick break right back after this with Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Stick around.
America for the better.
Hi, I'm Bob Snyder, president of Teamsters Local 776 here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. For more than 100 years, Teamsters have been standing together to create a better tomorrow. We Teamster members are your friends and neighbors. Teamsters move goods across the nation, take care of seniors, serve and protect our community, and so much more. We are hardworking, dedicated professional workers, united to make our lives, our communities, and our nation stronger. If you want to be part of the team, join the Teamsters for a better tomorrow. Contact us at 1-800-692-6280. That's 1-800-692-6280. Or visit our website at TeamstersLocal776.org. We are people helping people.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. I still can't get it out of my head. You're talking about one out of every 45 kids in this country homeless last year. You look at the numbers, you're seeing poverty through the roof. Nearly 50% of folks either in poverty or considered low income, one in six on food stamps, one in four kids eating because of food stamps. And we got a Republican Party who's quite happy sending the taxes on us working people upward. They've got no problem with it. In fact, if you watched it today, it was just Well, it was just mind-blowing. Anyway, here to tell us what went on in Washington today, our good friend Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Ellen, how are you doing today?
I'm doing okay.
I got to tell you, I couldn't watch much more of it today without wanting to jump through the screen and strangle John Boehner and the rest of them.
Well, particularly since he comes off looking as if it was him that wants to keep Congress in town so that they would be able to do this for 12 months. Not just 2 months. And he comes off like, what are you guys talking about? We're willing to stay in town. It's really kind of amazing.
Now, let me ask you this, because, you know, there have been a lot of reports out. Because early on, it was reported that Boehner thought it was a good idea, kind of a victory kind of thing. And he was favor, if I'm not getting this wrong, he was in favor of it. But now the word has kind of turned around that it's the Tea Party people who want no part of it. Is this true?
Well, I think the Tea Party people are kind of tired of Boehner. They see him as, you know, as business as usual, and they want something different.
Yeah, they want cut, gut, and punish. I know, I get it.
Exactly.
They want to make sure that the one in four kids who are eating because one out of every four kids who are eating because they're getting food stamps want to make sure that they don't. Because as that good South Carolina Republican said, his mama done told him that if you feed them thar strays, they're just going to multiply. Remember him?
Yes.
Again, you know, I disconnect from reality, I guess. And I guess, you know, I think about myself and I put myself in that position because, you know, I could easily claim to be the guy who pulled myself up by my bootstraps, but it was food stamps that fed me when I was a child, and it was health insurance through the government that saved my life. And I guess I can't forget those things.
Well, of course not. And so many people that have been helped by government programs, and as I think Clinton used to say, or maybe Obama says, you know, we're not giving a hand out, we're giving a hand up.
Yeah, and I look at what this whole shenanigans. You know, if this, and I think Hoyer is right, if this were a tax cut for the millionaires and billionaires, it would have sailed right through. They'd have been on the golf course by lunch.
That's for sure, because there would have been so much money behind it.
And as I've said so often, I mean, people like me, unfortunately, I don't have lobbyists. I don't have high-priced. I can't afford them. Can't afford high-priced lobbyists to go and get me, the 2% tax break that they're talking about.
Absolutely.
So where's this going to go? I mean, are you getting any sense that they're ready to take this to the mat?
I get the sense that they've gone home. And I don't know what the president is going to do. And when the White House just released a schedule for tomorrow, it's very, they're not saying what he's going to do.
That's why I think we need to take to the streets. I've been saying it for the longest time. Bring back Coxey and his army. Start marching on Washington.
The problem is that I'm not sure at this point we can get people out of their houses enough to do it.
Yeah, well, as the old labor saying goes, sometimes when your stomach's empty, your head gets right.
Ooh, I like that.
Yeah, well, you know, it is what it is. I mean, when you're back, the problem is people aren't really ready to make that snap because we all still got a little something left to lose. And there's part of me that says the Republicans are really flirting with trouble because if you're not going to extend food stamps for those 1 in 4 children and the 1 in 6 people who are getting them, those 1 in 4 children and 1 in 6 people are going to take to the streets because they've got nothing left. You're giving them no alternative. There's only one place for them to go, and that's to take it from you. Because I'll tell you, I'll be honest with you. If it's my kids starving, if I got to look at my kids in the eye who are hungry, one way or another, they're going to eat.
Right, of course.
And maybe it will take to that point. But here again, I mean, what is it? I saw a statistic, 1 in 32 people in this country are locked up. How many more can we lock up?
Oh, and I mean, they wonder why the crime statistics are down. It's because we have such a high lockup rate. And I don't know if you saw in the paper the other day, a really interesting study. It was in a couple of the national papers that they found that kids who were 23 and under had like one out of every six.
One-third.
I mean, it's unbelievable. It's one-third have been arrested.
Yeah, and it's mostly because of our really restrictive drug laws and these minimum sentencing requirements that the for-profit prison industry made sure they got through, again, with their high-priced lobbyists.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah, because I've got, you know, I had friends, you know, years ago who, you know, they got caught with a little bit of something, and they ended up having to do, you know, 60 days or whatever it was. But you know, there was minimum. They had to do it.
It's quite amazing.
Well, it all comes down to we've privatized the prison system, and now it's a profit-making entity. So what better way to make profit than to lock people up?
And if you think about, you know, they think, oh, we're going to lock somebody up. But these people, most of them have children or wives or husbands. And what do you do with how it affects the kids' lives?
Don't care, because you see, if you feed them, you take care of them, they're going to multiply. So you just let them wither and wither on the vine. Let them go.
It makes me speechless.
Is that not speechless
that these guys left them out of town today?
Well, it makes me speechless that we can't get this done. And again, you know, maybe it's going to take that shock. Maybe it's going to take that the first time they look at their check and they go, oh man, my check went down. What happened? Maybe that will shock somebody awake and realize that the Republicans are hell-bent on making sure that the Koch brothers and the rest of the billionaire class are well taken care of and on the plush, while the rest of us, screw job. Anyway, let's move on. Kim Jong-il. Kim Jong-il no longer ill. I guess he's dead. So we talked to an expert last night about where maybe Korea goes, North Korea goes. His son Kim Jong-un is now the dear leader or the supreme leader or the head poobah or whatever you want to call him. Some news about that today?
Well, the news is that China has actually accepted it and is recognizing the new government. So China, of course, has their eyes and ears on North Korea, as always. And so they're going ahead with any new plans.
Any word in Washington on the direction that they think that this guy is going to take? Because as I've read, you know, he did study in Switzerland for a little bit, so maybe he has some idea of the outside world. And then the other part of me, you know, I get this very Machiavellian feeling from this situation as the youngest child having to prove himself and maybe take out the other two. Could be very interesting to watch.
It is not going to be boring.
Well, may you live in interesting times. And let's look at Iraq. I guess the president's had another ceremony today?
He did have another ceremony. In this ceremony, he received the flag that had flown over at least one of our bases in Iraq, and that was the ceremony that took place at Andrews Air Force Base today.
I think we should.
We're out of Iraq, except Iraq seems to not be doing too well since we closed up shop there.
What's going on there?
Well, essentially, the vice president has been arrested. He is Sunni. The president is Shiite. And the Sunni various members of the cabinet are ready to walk out because they're accusing the vice president of having death squads and all that kind of thing. The vice president says none of it is true, and the president is just essentially trying to embarrass him.
What's that? What's the saying from the Who song? The new guy, same as the old guy.
Right. Yeah. Kind of same, only different.
Yeah. And again, I think we should be having celebrations across the country that we're out of there. We should be throwing ticker tape parades. We should be doing all those things. Welcome those soldiers back. Get them jobs. Get them situated. And leave Iraq to what it's going to end up happening there. That's just my thought on it. I shouldn't have been there in the first place.
I do not disagree at all. But we're there and we're leaving, and then look what happens as soon as we get out of there.
So what was the answer? I mean, I know Obama's going to take a beating over this, but at the end of the day, for me, we can't be there. We can't be taking on that kind of that kind of liability. We can't be paying for that. I mean, we can't even get our own children health insurance. We got a party that's in this country that won't extend a tax cut to working people, or they want to deny children food stamps. I mean, but we got money to play in the sandbox.
That's exactly the problem. We've spent all the sandbox money. We've busted our budget, and what have we got to show for it? A vice president of a country, now that we've made it democratic, who's been accused by the president of all kinds of things and turning into essentially another civil war.
What I find really interesting is that we went over there and we protected their right to vote because everybody had same-day registration. You went in, you put your little finger on the ink, and you showed your ink finger, and you got the vote. Here in this country, we want to have photo IDs, and we want to have poll tests, and next it'll be underwear size, and who knows what.
Maybe we ought to go to the finger.
I'm all in favor of same-day registration. I'm all in favor of having a whole week, a celebration of voting. It is our right, after all. It is one of those things that, you know, is great about this country. Your right to vote, your right to the ballot box should be accessible.
You are getting no problems from me tonight on any of this. Well, the problem is we have a Congress that just, I hope they go home for Christmas and they have people on them saying, what did you not do? That's what I hope.
I'm right there with you. Anyway, Ellen Ratner, always great talking with you. Look forward to talking to you again.
Thank you.
Let's take a quick break right back after this. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
I'll never bend. I'm with you now.
Thought-provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
The 19th century saw regular work weeks of 70 hours or more. Many attempts were made to get legislatures across the country to pass maximum hour laws limiting the number of hours an employee could be compelled to labor. The first union victory in capping work hours was won by the building trades in 1840. They won a 60-hour week. In 1874, the state of Massachusetts became the first to pass a law mandating a maximum hours for women. Other states followed as union activists around the country fought to pass laws to protect workers. Their work stalled in 1905 when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled the New York Bake Shop Act unconstitutional, citing a sacred bond between master and employee and the liberty of contract. With this decision, the Lochner era, named after bakery owner Joseph Lochner, who had been cited, tried, and convicted of working employees beyond the 60-hour limit, began. This single decision opened the floodgates, allowing attacks on child labor laws, minimum wage laws, as well as maximum hour laws by corporate and anti-union interests. Only after President Franklin Delano Roosevelt threatened to enlarge the United States Supreme Court from 9 to 13 did the court do an about-face with regard to liberty of contract and what has been called a switch in time to save 9, ruling in West Coast Hotel versus Parrish that Elsie Parrish was indeed entitled to the state of Washington's minimum wage, regardless of what conditions she agreed to, marking the end of the Lochner era. FDR's New Deal policies helped workers reclaim lost ground in their fight for the American dream. The proposal and passage of the Fair Labor Standards Act, federally restricting weekly hours, mandating overtime pay, setting a minimum wage, and restricting the exploitive use of child labor, was an essential step forward for workers, families, and communities. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center of IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Exposing GOP hypocrisy, The Rick Smith Show.
That's right. We want it now. We want it all. All of it. Every bit of it. Every last bit. We want everything we want. We want it now. At least that's what the Republicans are saying. Kicking and screaming. Kicking their feet. And you look at this whole fiasco that's gone on. The Republicans have really, you got to give them master, you got to give the masters credit. They really screwed this one up. Normally they're on the same page, but this time I think the Tea Party people really stuck it to the Republican Party and shows the fissures in the party. You look here in Pennsylvania, where the Tea Party people really took the party in an extreme direction. You look at all of the extreme policies because, you know, the Tea Party people here want to be able to go to their national functions and say, yes, we were just like Indiana or we were just like Wisconsin or Tennessee or Ohio or you know, Michigan or Florida. We're just like those Republicans. But the sane, rational Republicans, of which there still are some. And look, I beat up on the Republicans quite often because they're mostly the extreme party. Now, there are some rational people left that you can actually talk policy with, talk, you know, how are you going to govern? Do you believe in government? I mean, that's got to be the first question. And for me, anybody who tells me that they don't believe in government, that government can do nothing right, I ask the question, well, why do I want you there? I want someone who's going to fix the problems. I want someone who's going to say, yeah, we can do certain things. There's a lot of things we shouldn't be involved in, and those are discussions to be had. But the things that we do well. And I love the whole thing with O'Reilly not knowing that the military is controlled by the federal government. You go, really? He didn't know that? I mean, we pay a lot for it. And I've got my problems, but it's pretty well run, other than we throw a ton of money at it. And maybe if we threw a ton of money at education, maybe we would have no failing schools. But what I find amazing is that you've got the Republican Party, who are supposedly the tax crusaders, the people who, you know, they want to cut taxes, cut taxes, cut taxes. And I guess we never asked on who. Because, look, come the end of the year, taxes are going up on all of us. Now, you may not be thrilled with the 2%. But at the end of the day, it's still $20 in people's pockets. It's not going to be enough. And I look at this Wall Street Journal article. That kind of takes the Republicans to task and said, look, you've done something pretty amazing. You've turned Obama into a tax cutter. Congratulations. Considering that he's going to, if reelected, allow the Bush tax cuts to expire, and they're calling that the largest tax increase ever. Because, of course, you know, when Bush gave out the big handout, it was the largest handout of the time ever. So now when we go back to a sane, rational period where you say, sorry, you know, the party days are over, they're going to say, that's the biggest increase ever. So they're looking at this, and the Wall Street Journal, in their way, says, you know, what's the difference? A two-month extension of the tax holiday from 6.2 down to 4.2, what does it matter if it's 2 months or a year? Their position on it is no employer is ever going to hire anyone based on such a small temporary tax cut. They're just not going to do it. And what they're saying is this should have been a political exercise. You should have either figured out how to block it, or you should have figured out how to use it. So either you block it, you say, no, it's not going to happen, we're going to make sure, we're going to hold the line, and you have a strategy, or you use it to your credit. It was our idea, which it was at one point. It was a Republican idea. But you don't do what they're doing. And they should have passed it quickly. You should have just let it go. But no, you've got these ideologues who everything has to be a hostage situation. Everything has to be down to the wire. Everything has to be the ticking bomb. And that's where they've put us again. They've put us in this situation where now, you know, employers and my accountant called me. What are we doing? You do know this is going to happen. And I said, well, you know, we had to make a decision around that. We made the decision. But still, you know, at the end of the day, you want to talk about uncertainty? The Republicans keep telling us employers aren't hiring people because they're uncertain. Oh, what's going on in Washington? Well, here's another uncertainty. We're days away from the end of the year. And accountants across the country going, we don't know how to make out that first check of the year. Why? Well, because the Republicans are holding the nation hostage. So, you know, I talk to my Republican friends. Listen, folks, we need you to take your party back. And there's part of me that thinks the Democrats, that I should give up the Democratic Party and become a Republican and take that party over to start giving them some sane, rational ideas. Maybe if we become apolitical, we join both parties. Maybe, just a maybe, we'll agree on some things. Because right now the Republican Party is bought and paid for, completely co-opted by the billionaire class. I mean, look at this. I mean, this one exercise, this one payroll tax holiday, this should be that moment of clarity. This should be that epiphany where you go, oh, I get it. They're against raising taxes on everybody but me. They want tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires, but not me. Yeah, I think I'm starting to see. I see the light. I see the light. Yeah, I'm starting to get it. Because, you know, according to, and again, according to Republicans, tax cuts create jobs.
With a robust package of at least $550 billion and across-the-board tax relief, we will help create more than 1 million new jobs.
Didn't happen, but again, nice frame. Here's another, and again, you know, how many of these constitutional amendments do we need? How much more legislation do we need to overturn Citizens United? How much more? Representatives John Yarmuth, Democrat from Kentucky, and Republican Walter Jones from North Carolina, they introduced legislation today to overturn the Citizens United decision. Look, at some point, we've got to get the money out of it. Campaign contributions, in my opinion, I'm sorry, not free speech. But that is the key tenet of the Citizens United decision. $1, one vote, I guess, is the idea. But the more money you can spend, the more free speech you have, which is why all we see and hear on TV is, or on radio and everywhere, is the billionaire message. Which is why I've always been in favor of publicly financed elections. If we could go down that path, start saying, you know what, here's X amount of money. That's all you get. Run a campaign. Show me how fiscally responsible you are. Show me how good you are at using resources and building grassroots movements and bringing people, not dollars, into the process. Show me that. Show me organization. Now, one of the things I give Ron Paul credit for, he has got fantastic organization. A bunch of cult members, but still, they've got some good organization. And he's rising in the polls. And if you remember, you know, I said it a couple of weeks ago, as the Newtster was rising in the polls, the media giveth, the media taketh away. And in their, you know, the headline today was, you know, his popularity fading in Iowa and nationally. Why? I think most people realize why. He opened his mouth and people heard him. And when you say you're going to take on the federal court system, really? When you say you're going to have judges arrested or brought in front of Congress, like school children in front of the principal, I think people get a little uneasy. And when you find out now, as the folks at the Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, or CREW, what they're accusing him of is basically doing what Cheesy Dwarf did, profiting off his campaign. Evidently, he sold, according to the people at CREW, he sold his email list to his campaign for about $47,000. And then, of course, he failed to report the sale on his FEC document, but that's not worry about it. But again, you know, you go, really? You built this email list and you sold it to yourself? Will you then sell it back to yourself? Will your campaign then sell it back? And again, you know, you look at Cheesy Dwarf. He was the master at it. It started off as a book tour. He was in states nobody was going to. Why? Book tour. People were thrilled to see him. Oh, yeah, book tour. I'm going to buy some books. And then magically, the ringmaster, Reince Priebus, lifted him up in the polls a little bit. Problem is, he got a little uppity, didn't he? He got a little full of himself. Had to knock him down a couple of notches. And to his credit, he was smart enough to go, I'm not going to put up with this. I'm just dropping out. He's not a dumb guy. He knew when his time was up, and he left. Exit stage left. The problem is you've got Santorum and you've got Bachman. They don't know when to leave the party, which is why they're at the bottom. Nobody's even considering them, other than the fact that they're kooks. Nobody's even considering them because they don't play the game. I'm looking at this. I'm looking at the whole Republican primary and very much in a world championship wrestling frame. It's all about trying to get people excited and really pointing against Obama. Because after all,
I hope he fails.
I don't know how much clearer they can be from the day Obama took office.
I hope he fails.
I mean, they were very clear, unified.
I hope he fails.
On and on. You had McConnell say, we're going to make him a one-term president. And you say, when do you start believing what they're telling you? So I find it interesting. I find it quite interesting that that is what they have done. Last story, last quick one. The family leader guy says that Rick Santorum is just like him, one of them. Anyway, have a great night. We'll see you tomorrow night.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of blood beneath the blood's sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous array. Democracy is coming.
It's the Rick Smith Show on